Hey, Justice Kite.
Good morning.
You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning to all of you, and I will take a few moments here at the beginning to just give a little brief summary of our budget request and our operations. I guess I'll start out by first of all thanking you all for the service that you provide the citizens of Wyoming. I wouldn't want to be sitting on your side of the table in the next month and a half. Here with me today are a number of members of our judicial branch. Here at the table with me is Joanne Odendahl, who most of you know, who is our court administrator and chief budget guru, and who will answer most of your questions here today. Also with me here, I think we have all of the members of our Wyoming Supreme Court. We have Justice Michael Golden in the back, Justice James Burke, Justice William Hill, and Justice Bart Voigt. We also have two district judges with us today that will be talking to you about the district judge budget, and that is Judge Wade Waldrop from Rollins and Judge John Brooks from Douglas. Our other staff members here present are Rhonda Munger, who is our deputy court administrator, and Christy Racine, who is our chief, one of our internal auditors, and Stephen Dreher, who you will also be hearing from, who is our court technology officer. Also with us are two members of the Board of Directors of the Center for Wyoming Legal Services, and you'll be hearing from them at the end of our presentation, Pat Day, who is the president of the board, and Raylan Job, who is a board member of that organization, and they are, as you will see, part of our budget. I'll just make a few general comments. Our total budget request is $57.5 million, which, as you all know, is relatively small part of the state budget, big to us, but represents about 2% of the state budget. Our exception request is a $12.3 million, and it's important as we go through this to emphasize that request, $9.3 million, represents a one-time request for technology, and the purpose of it is to finish the project that you all have already funded. We're about 50% through that project. And so it looks big in proportion to our budget, but it is a one-time request. The budget request includes a request for salary increases to our staff statewide. You will recall last year that we were kind of late to the party in terms of the salary increases to try to get employees to 91% of market. Over the last 6 or 8 months, we went through the process with the Hay Consulting Group at your request, and it was an interesting process. We learned a lot. I think it was a beneficial exercise. The result of that process is a $2.1 million request to get our employees to 91% of market, and in following that that Hay methodology, we have no new positions that we're requesting. We have shown on our handouts the impacts of 2%, 5%, and 8% reductions that you had requested that we show. We don't have programs as such that can be eliminated. We have personnel who are delivering judicial services and to the public. So if we had to go through that process, we would have to cut it out of support, supplies, and those kinds of things, kind of like we did last time when we had faced those reductions. But those are shown on our handouts.
Judge, when you get to on the last 10%, how did you, if you would remind us, what you did with the 10%? Did we give that back to you since then, or
I'm going to have Joanne answer that. We took it out of a number of different categories, and I'm not sure. I'll let you give the detail.
Mr. Chairman, Joanne Odendahl, the majority of the reductions that we took were in out-of-state travel. We also took a large portion out of our law library for the collection purchases, and then we transferred four positions from general fund appropriation to a special fund in technology.
Then the next question have those dollars been recovered since then? Are they back into your travel budgets, or did you keep them out? What's happened to that?
No, Mr. Chairman. As we go through our budget request, you will see that those funds have not been added back to our budget.
IT remain transferred out of your IT budget?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
which then gives you less money for your IT work, I assume.
That's correct, and we'll go into more detail about that. I do want to say at the beginning that we are very cognizant of the environment that we are operating in and that you're operating in, and we are committed as a branch of government to conserving the resources that we do have and using them in the most effective way that we can. There are a couple things that we've done as an organization that I want you to be aware of that I think demonstrates our commitment to that use of resources. The first thing is we increased the jurisdiction of the circuit courts with the legislature's support last year, and that resulted in a much better usage of our circuit court system. Over 1,000 filings have been filed in circuit court as opposed to district court over the last 6 months. So that gives us a little bit of room on the district court side, who those district court judges who are clearly overburdened, and we think it was a good step towards efficient use of resources. We did that with no increase in personnel at the circuit court level. We are studying, based on the funds you provided last time, the usage of those circuit court clerks, and we will not be filling any positions unless that study demonstrates the need. We established, without any additional state funds, we designed and implemented an electronic payment system for citations, and that was really due to the hard work and the ingenuity of our IT department, and they did that, like I say, with our existing budget. That has been functioning beautifully. Millions of dollars coming in a lot faster from essentially 24 hours a day and all over the world, so at least we're making a step in the direction of joining the 21st century on the side of the judicial branch. We are working with a lot of energy and time on this district court electronic filing system, docket management system, and then moving on to the circuit court system. So it's taking up a lot of our resources and our time of our support staff, and we hope, as we'll have Mr. Dreher talk to you a little bit more about it, we'll tell you, in terms of the status of that project. But that will really, I think, increase our efficiency branch-wide through the whole judicial branch. We have provided you with three handouts that I'll just summarize. The first one, there are frequently questions about which court does what and the size of the court. So this first handout that just demonstrates the Supreme Court, the number of people, the number of cases. The district court, we have 22 district court judges with almost 19,300 filings for the last year. The district courts are our courts of general jurisdiction, and they handle felonies and all domestic relations, juvenile matters, large civil cases. The circuit courts, we have 24 circuit court judges around the state with 130 circuit court clerks, and that operation is under the direct supervision of the Supreme Court. The district courts each operate their operations independently. 179,800 plus filings in the circuit court, so it tells you the volume of filings that go through those courts, and those filings represent a lot of money. At the same time, those courts handle over $13 million, or maybe $30 million. I thought that was wrong. $30 million in the course of a year. So we've got, you know, all kinds of issues and auditing and control that, frankly, they're running those very well. We are proud of the work those circuit courts have done. So that gives you just a brief overview. The other two handouts we'll get into more detail. It gives you the timeline for our district court electronic filing projects and circuit court projects, and then the last is a document that shows the effect of a 2, 5, or 8% reduction should we have to face that, and Joanne will go into that in more detail.
Just a moment. Don, do you have another copy of those handouts? Apparently.
Are you short?
Did you get more than one?
Yeah.
They look like this.
Yeah, apparently Kurt's already lost his.
You know,
he hasn't even got up from his desk.
Do they have enough? Excuse me.
We just want to make sure he's got a chart.
With that general summary, I will turn the presentation of our budget over to Joanne Odendahl, and I'm available, of course, to answer any questions that you might have as we proceed. Joanne?
All right. Thank you, Chief Justice Kite. Okay.
Excuse us, Joanne. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do hope everyone has the corrected copy of the judicial branch budget. It's a little darker purple. And as you turn to the Supreme Court section, on page one, I do want to point out there is a memo from the Chief Justice to you all and making recommendations on requests that you will see in our budget proposal. Each request that comes to our office is reviewed a couple of times, and nothing goes in the Supreme Court budget without the final approval of all five justices. When you go to mark up the budgets, this is the memorandum that you will use from the recommendations of the Chief Justice. Turning on to page six in the Supreme Court section, it kind of gives you an outline or an overview of the different divisions that fall under the Supreme Court. As Chief Justice Kite indicated, the circuit courts are under the Supreme Court, as well as the law library, technology that we provide services to the entire judicial branch, and Board of Judicial Policy and Administration, where we provide funds that will support different projects throughout the entire state, circuit court, district court, and Supreme Court. And we will be going through those divisions one by one. You can see in column seven, it gives you an overview of our exception requests according to those particular divisions. Moving on, Mr. Chairman, to page eight, you can see, again, an overview by program, the amount of money that is requested for each program, indicating that circuit courts is about 45% of our entire Supreme Court budget, and personnel services is about 67% of our entire budget.
Joanne, when you do you have an occasion to look at what other court technology budgets are and as a percentage to their budgets compared to your own?
In other states, no, Mr. Chairman, I have not.
You know, as we looked, we're going to, over time, I think, look to consolidation of IT services throughout the state. We always have the issue with respect to you folks, whether or not and to what extent it's prudent to have some shared IT services for if we can essentially get more bang for our buck for the taxpayer. But I know you like having your own IT services, but what you might do for us over the course of next couple of weeks is see if you can't compare your IT budgets to some other states. I don't know if it may be not comparing apples to oranges because of the way your court system is set up, but trying to sort out then what is an appropriate percentage of IT for your general mm-hmm. budget.
Okay, certainly. Mr. Chairman, as you can see on page 9 and 10, again, it's just a summary of our exception budget request. Again, this is a lot of charts and information as we move through here, and I won't bore you with all of the details. I do want to point out on page 13, Mr. Chairman, we will start the administration division. And for the new members, out of respect for you all, I know this is a little bit confusing. The judicial branch does do their budget proposal a little different than the executive branch. We do try to color code our budget to make it a little easier. Anything that you see in black is an overview information for your on your behalf or on our behalf to tell you what we do. Anything that you see in blue is a standard budget narrative. And anything you see in brown is an exception budget narrative so that those hopefully pop out to you and you can see exactly what we're requesting. If you look on page 14, then, you can see the corresponding color coding in the different columns. Column 6, the amounts are in blue that compare to the standard budget. Column 7, they should be brown to correspond with the brown narrative, which are, again, our exception budget requests. In the administration division, we do cover the expenses for our justices, their law clerks, staff attorneys, judicial assistants, our clerk of Supreme Court, and the employees within that office, and the court administration office, which are HR people, financial employees who transfer funds to different agencies, who handle all of the invoices that come in for not only the Supreme Court but also the Circuit Court. Every dollar that is spent from the Supreme Court budget comes through our office for approval and auditing purposes as well. Everything is checked. We are requesting, as you can see under the exception budget request, we do request $58,000 in dues and licenses. $40,000 of that request is for the increased cost in our dues to the National Center for State Courts. It has increased since 2007. It was $67,000 a year, and now in 2012, it is $83,000 a year. In the past, we have tried to make up that difference out of other categories in our budget, but again, because of the budget cuts we've experienced, we are no longer able to do that. So we are here today asking for the funds to pay those dues. And I do believe it's very consistent with the Conference of State Legislators.
We pay our dues. I don't know what our – we'll look to see what our dues are. But did you have a chance to see what our dues are?
I did not, no, Mr. Chairman.
What are you getting from the National Center? I mean, what do you actually get from them?
Well, we get – you know, it's sort of only limited by our requests. Some of the projects that you request their help on, you have to pay for. But the Conference of Chief Justices funded out of that. That's an – biannual or twice a year conference that the chief tries to attend. And it, you know, it really is helpful to see what's going on around the country and to see the experience they're having in things like electronic filing and access to justice and other things that are that other states are facing. It is a valuable service to us, I think. They also provide consulting for court management questions, and I believe we have learned a lot from that project. So it's one of those things that, you know, it's hard to quantify dollar for dollar, but it is a valuable service to us, I think.
Next, Mr. Chairman, you will see a request for $18,000 for Westlaw. And again, we have tried to make up the difference out of categories in our current standard budget, but we are no longer able to afford to do that. Westlaw is a research engine that is used by our justices, their staff attorneys, and law clerks as they prepare opinions, and Westlaw in conjunction with our law library for resources.
Total Westlaw bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I don't have the actual contract with me.
Do you combine with the AG's office for buying power, or have you ever looked into that to our other state agencies?
Mr. Chairman, what we do is combine the district judges, the circuit judges, and the Supreme Court for the judicial branch.
Question then is, has anybody inquired as whether we take a look at all of our state services for Westlaw and see whether we can get a better overall rate if they're negotiated together? It may be that Westlaw just doesn't do that. They may just set their fee, but I guess the question is, has anybody even looked into it?
Mr. Chairman, no, I have not looked into that.
Could you do that for us, please?
Certainly.
Thank you. And then we'll see Attorney General Phillips. We'll ask him or something.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question on Westlaw. I assume this is something that you use continually. Is this an additional request on top of, you know, your standard budget is $149,000? Are you already paying for Westlaw? Is this something new, or, and why is it an exception? Why wouldn't it just be in your regular? I'm assuming this is a tool you use.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edmonds, it is a tool that we have been using for several years. We do have a contract with Westlaw. That, again, the contract, the amount keeps increasing. And so we have tried to make up the difference in years past, but we are no longer able to do so. Next, Mr. Chairman, $74,000 is requested in professional fees. $54,000 of that request is to cover the cost of the Hay Group study that we did do at your request. It was interesting, as Chief Justice Kite indicated. Chief Justice Kite, Judge Young, myself, and Rhonda Munger sat down with Neville Kenning of Hay Group, went through each category or each classification of our positions and had to rate them. We had to look at the job descriptions, and it was an interesting process. We didn't always agree, but we came to an understanding. And you will see the actual request for salaries in a budget further down the in this book. But this is the amount to pay for the cost of that study, and I do believe there was a conversation that you all understood. We would have to pay for that contract now, and so we would wait to pay the National Center until after July 1, until this request was approved. And this is, even though it is not referenced here, this is a one-time request, so I do ask that you make a note of that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just for my own edification on the market salaries for external positions, similar to court positions. Can you just define external positions for me?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Van Flouten, it's called an external cost adjustment to get employees up to 91% of market. They are actually judicial branch employees. And not every employee will be brought up to 91 or will receive a pay raise. They are already at 91% of market. But that is called an external cost adjustment. Right.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I may, Senator Van Flattern, the process, as you all are probably very familiar with, the Hay process is to compare the salaries that we were paying with the private sector as well as the executive branch as well as surrounding states. So they compare us to those external factors in order to determine an appropriate salary.
This primarily looks like it's classified employees, so you didn't look at any market evaluation as far as the judges themselves?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, we did ask the Hay Group to also review salaries of judges in the other states, yes.
Yeah. I'm just curious, Mr. Chairman, if we were to look at, say, a $12,000 increase for the Supremes, how much that would cost as it was implemented down the whole system.
Tell you what, we have, there's a, we went ahead and had a bill prepared. It's pretty funny because so we have this bill prepared to give the judges a salary. And we sent out cards to all the lawyers in both the House and the Senate. The only instruction of the staff was send out a card to every lawyer. And the only lawyer who sent a card back that said he wouldn't support the bill was Senator Scott. Yeah, well, I don't know why he got a card, but apparently if you give an instruction to send a card out to every lawyer, Senator Scott gets
one. Mr. Chairman, if I may answer, I think there might be some confusion with Senator Meyer's question. The request for an increase to judicial salaries is not included in this budget. It'll be handled in that separate bill. So the actual numbers aren't in here. I just want to make sure we had that clear.
So we've got all the lawyers have to be on. Everybody feels left out. There's already too many people. Let's talk about salaries just a little bit. The total cost of the Hay study was, is that the 54?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And is there any more that you owe them on that, or is that job finished?
Mr. Chairman, that job is finished. I don't believe we received our final invoice.
Now, as we go through this budget analysis, and I think everybody has to remember, and maybe I want to make sure that I understand well, in general, are your salaries lagging those behind, or are you ahead or in front of the executive branch?
Mr. Chairman, overall, we are behind.
When you say overall, that's what I don't like. I mean, are there some of you here that are ahead and there's some behind?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We do have some positions who are ahead of the executive branch, but they're unique positions to our judicial branch. For instance, the clerk of Supreme Court, that is a unique position there's nothing to compare it with the executive branch, but we have compared it with the other 12 states that the Hay Group used with the executive branch.
Well, I appreciate, having gone through the Hay study myself, the Hay Group, I understand the frustration. In the end of the day, though, on those categories of employees where you had a disagreement on, will they be receiving some additional salary increase? Or are you going to redline them, or what are you going to do with them?
Mr. Chairman, we do have positions that are over 100% that are going to be redlined. We do have positions that you will see later in our request. There may be, I think it's $173,000 that we've asked for to give pay raises to those employees who might be between 91 and 100% of market, who do extreme, who have, you know, performance, and the justices or judges feel that their law clerks or judicial assistant may deserve a pay raise. So that will be left up to the district judge or the justices. But overall, most of our clerk positions out and around the state are well below the market.
Now, when we, at the end of the day, when you finished up the work with the Hay Group, do you have a table that compares your salaries with the AGs and with the other, the public defenders and those? Do we have that table any longer? Or?
Mr. Chairman, the table that we received had salaries identified. It didn't really say AG's office or any other agency. It was just a number that Hay Group provided to us for certain positions, and then the indication whether or not it was below 85% of market or 91% of market.
Well, I guess what, if you would, Joanne, give us some your final analysis document. Show us which employees you had a disagreement with the Hay Group, so that we at least know that if we're giving, if you're requesting salary increases for a position where you have a disagreement and you're going to be paying them, that employee, more, we at least ought to know what that disagreement is. And then with respect to the attorneys, some sort of table so that we know that we're not playing leapfrog, that ultimately you're catching up. It gets more complicated because the AG's office has principally been paid out, I think, a lot of the X-band dollars that we put out for market adjustments. And I don't know, we'll talk to Attorney General Phillips here when he gets up here to find out, but we just need to have some way to keep track of where we're moving and that we're not doing this leapfrog. And the flip side of that is that if we don't give out any salary dollars, your position is, look, we're lagging behind everyone else, so this is a catch-up for us. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chairman, that absolutely is. I mean, first of all, we didn't get the increase last year that the executive branch got, and we can provide you with that comparison.
You vetoed your bill.
Yeah, there's a long story there. we can provide you with the assurances, I think, that you're asking for, that we're not trying to go ahead of the executive branch. We're trying to catch up. But I think it is fair to say that this whole Hay process was a little bit more of an art than a science, to me, anyway. They gave us a lot of ranges and general comparisons, and it's very hard to pinpoint, except with attorneys. We can go in there, and some of those positions are very similar. But we can provide you with that detail to assure you that we're simply trying to catch up.
In the end of the day, how does the Hay Group, or how did you guys come to a conclusion comparing, for example, a first-year attorney in the AG's office versus a law clerk?
Mr. Chairman, I can tell you that we were very conservative in what we had originally requested. The Hay Group did provide to us information from, I can tell you, the Attorney General's office. They did not go through and compare each position. But our starting salaries for attorneys right out of law school were anywhere from $3,000 to $10,000 less than what the AG started individuals. So what we've tried to put together are just proposals for an attorney pay plan based exactly on the Attorney General's pay plan. This has not been adopted by the district court judges yet. We did not want to present any certain amounts of money for any employee until we know exactly what has been appropriated for the judicial branch. The district judges will sit down and go through their particular positions and decide how they want to do the pay plan for their attorneys and hopefully be consistent. And the Supreme Court will also have the same pay plan to start all new law clerks at the same salary.
I'm not sure I understood that. So you guys have already identified a pay band that you're going to try to hit, and the DJs have not, they're not part of that, or do you expect to pay your clerks more or less than the district court judge clerks?
Mr. Chairman, we have had preliminary conversations with Judge Waldrop, who is the president of the District Judges Conference, Norm Young, who was the outgoing president of their conference, and they understand the amount of money that's being requested for the district courts, and yet they did not want to just give that information out to anyone just yet, again, until a final number has been decided by this committee. We pretty much are set to go forward, but until we know the final number, we don't want to tell individuals what the expectation is.
I can understand you're not wanting to disclose that, but we need to know. I mean, maybe give us some papers showing us, but what is the general philosophy? Is the philosophy that all law clerks should be paid alike, or that the Supreme Court is a better job and commands a better salary, or that the Supreme Court has an easier time getting clerks and can command a lower salary?
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, our proposal is to treat the district judge, law clerks, and JAs in the same fashion as our law clerks and JAs. I think what Joanne's trying to say is we don't control exactly how they administer their pay, but the plan that we have proposed is to treat them equally.
Yeah. We're going through then on the dollars, if we do appropriate them, are they going to be earmarked for only salaries so that it can't be moved to any other part of the budgets?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, yes. That request is for just salaries. And again, it's according to years of experience, very similar to what the Attorney General's office has as their pay plan for attorneys.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me get this clear in my mind. So you're requesting us to appropriate money for this Hay Group study, and the services have been rendered prior to the appropriation of the money. Is that?
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Stewart, we obviously had a time crunch, and the study had to be done last year, and we discussed it with the co-chairman about we used the money that was allocated for the payment of the dues to the Center for State Courts, because obviously the Hay Group wasn't going to work for free, and we had to get the study done in time to come to the budget session. So we moved money around, and this is money to replace the money that we paid them for with. Is that
what happened? You recall during the last budget bill, we put in money for their staff salaries, but required that it go through A&I. There was, and at least I've forgotten the full dispute, but ultimately that got line itemed out by the governor. The money stayed in the executive branch salaries, and it was about $700,000. Then we had meetings with the Supreme Court and said, look, you've got to move forward on some sort of a salary study, a compensation study. And since we had the governor had line itemed out that item, we said, pay for it, and then we'll backfill it.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It just seemed a little odd the way we're not used to doing it that way. So thank you for that review.
It is a little unusual, but it was the first time that we pushed the Supreme Court to engage in a salary study, an outside salary study, comparable to the executive branch, but trying to also keep the lines between the executive branch and the judiciary. So we had to recognize that there are some distinctions, but there are some common features. So this is sort of the accommodation that we made.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, moving on, you will also see in that request for $74,000, $20,000 is requested to provide continuing judicial education for our judges. In this current biennium, we have cut approximately $134,000 in out-of-state travel. So our circuit court judges are no longer traveling out of state, but they are required to get the continuing judicial education. So we are requesting $20,000 to provide a good caliber speaker to come to the state of Wyoming and provide that training. Mr. Chairman, moving on to page 16, we have a few revenue funds that come into the Supreme Court that we do want to make sure you are aware of. The first one is on page 16, which is the pro se packets. You can see the 10 packets listed there. These packets are on our website at the Supreme Court. Any citizen can go onto our website and download this packet. They are mostly dealing with divorce, a divorce with children, custody modifications, and those types of things. If a citizen wants to go into their local clerk of district court's office, they can purchase the packet for $10. That $10 then is sent to the Supreme Court, deposited through the state treasurer's office, put in a fund to where we can pay Kinko's to replenish that inventory then. So it's a revolving account, basically. It's just to cover those expenses. Again, we have a $50,000 spending authority that should be sufficient. These particular packets will be moving to the website for the Wyoming Center for Legal Aid. We currently have a balance of $136,000 in that fund. As those funds increase and legislative changes are made, we do pay contract attorneys to update those packets so that they are up to date with any of your legislative changes.
How many divorces a year do we have in the state of Wyoming? This is enough for 5,000 or 2,500 divorces a year in packets. So I'm just curious, is do we hit, 2,000 divorces a year or better in the state? Or
Miss,
is that a Platte County?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Meyer, it's difficult to estimate how many of those divorces are done by without a lawyer. That's what the pro se obviously means, and we don't have real good data about that. We can tell you we've got 3,300 marriage dissolution cases filed in a year, but how many of those use these pro se packets, it's very difficult to tell.
Yeah, I saw one advertising divorces for $119 in the newspaper the other day, so they must be getting, somebody's pretty desperate, I think, to get into the legal business,
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, moving on to page 18, we have the Children's Justice Project. This is a federal grant that we have received for approximately the last 12 years. Majority of these fund dollars are used for training. We do have a pilot project out in the district court in Green River that is implementing a data collection software for abused and neglected children to keep on track of the timelines that are necessary to get that particular case through the court system. And again, this is just a spending authority and just for your information. On page 20, Mr. Chairman, we have another revenue fund entitled Credit Card Convenience Fees. As Chief Justice Kite indicated, in this last year, we have implemented an e-pay online system that allows anyone to pay a citation from the privacy of their home. We have approximately $2.7 million being collected in the last calendar year, actually. We have been allowing credit cards since 2006, but it was a cumbersome process that took a lot of time for a clerk, so this e-pay system has really helped the clerk time in our circuit courts. And we do have
Just a question on the narration at the beginning, credit card convenience fees, last line.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about fines paid. If you walk into the court, it not charge the convenience fee. Any reason for that?
That's right. According to Mr. Chairman, according to the credit card companies that we work with, that is not providing a convenience, so to speak. The convenience comes when you want to pay online and not go into an office. And so we do charge what's called a $5 convenience fee to pay online. That convenience fee then turns around and pays for the services that we have to pay out to allow you to pay that to use that credit card. We currently have a balance of $174,000 in that account, and that has been fluctuating from month to month. We do feel the $5 convenience fee is sufficient to cover the expense to us. And again, Mr. Chairman, I do want to point out that the exception budget request that we have there for $400,000 is a spending authority request. This is not general fund dollars.
I guess a follow-up on the credit card companies telling you you can't charge a fee to use their card. Is that a federal law that prohibits you in doing that? Do you need a state statute that allows you to do that? It seems like, gosh, you're the Supreme Court. Why can't you tell the credit card companies that, yeah, we're gonna charge that because you're charging it, and we have to have 100% of our fine paid. Because we're paying. If you get a $100 fine, there's only $98 going back to the school. So, you know, I'm just curious as to where the authority lies and whether we need to statutorily have some authority to charge that when somebody walks.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I don't know if it's a federal law. The companies that we have discussed any of this with have said that, yes, it is a convenience, but you're doing your business face-to-face, and they don't charge as much of a fee to us, a processing fee to us, as they do for those individuals who pay online. If you have to key in a credit card number, you pay a little more for that particular service. And so it's very... The contract is very clear on the percentages for each way you pay by a credit card and how the vendor is a charge for those to allow you that convenience. It is a convenience in some respects, but the main convenience is not having to go into that office to pay face-to-face.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just clarify, Senator Meyer, we are collecting everything that the company is charging us, so we get our total fine paid to the state. Right. We're requiring the person who pays with a credit card to pay the credit card company's fee. The state of Wyoming is not doing that. So it's a 100% recovery of what the company is charging us, and that's just what this represents. They pay us the fee, and then we pay the credit card company, but it's a complete wash. So I just didn't want any misunderstanding.
And I understand that on the e-pay, but if somebody walks in the door, you're charging them $102 rather than $100.
No, it's the other way around. When they walk in the door, we're charging them $100, and they pay with their credit card, and the company doesn't charge us. Am I got that right?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. We're not charged as much of a fee if you pay face to face. The $5 convenience fee that we do charge for paying online covers that charge that we may be paid. Overall, it covers the cost to us to provide the ability for individuals to use credit cards, yes.
Okay, and I think what the chairman said is that you got enough people paying $105 that the people that are walking in and they're only charged $100, but it costs you maybe you only get $98 back out of it. The $105 makes up for the $98 and it's wash.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I don't completely understand this. I really hesitate, Mr. Chairman, to disagree with Joanne, but whatever the credit card companies charge us, we are collecting from the person who makes the payment. And I don't know why it's in kind of counterintuitive, but they do this, banks do it, and other people collecting money charge you to use a payment over the online. And it seems like it would be more efficient from them, but it doesn't.
Well, what I understand Joanne's saying is you're charging a $5 fee for people that are doing the e-file or the e-payments, and that the collections from that are sufficient to cover all of your credit card expenses. But the person that walks in the door, plops down a credit card, he's paying 100% of his fine or payment with the credit card. And in this sense, actually, with the Supreme Court, are these, let's go back, are these for fines and for paying for filing fees, or are they just for fines?
Mr. Chairman, it is the fines and fees for traffic violations only that can be paid online. But I do want to be clear, it's a flat rate. Whether or not your traffic ticket is $400 versus $50, if you want to pay that credit card or that traffic violation online, you are charged the same convenience fee. It is very similar to if you were on eBay or whatever and pay that handling fee. You're paying the same rate no matter what your traffic violation is.
But here's, we go back and look at, we've had this problem throughout state government. and the Secretary of State will, when we go back and talk about them, what they do for collection. But generally the notion is that if the statute says your fine is $100, you're required to pay $100, and if you want the convenience of putting it on your credit card and there's a fee associated, that charge should go back to the person that bring in the credit card. And otherwise, one person's paying, say, $99 for their fine, and the other one's paying $100 for their fine, because the person that's bringing in cash is going to pay $100. The person that's bringing in a credit card is paying $99. And we had heard in the past with respect to credit cards do have these policies that say, look, we don't want you to discourage the use of our cards, so you have to charge the same customer the same price for credit card versus non-credit card. But we have gotten through it with these, essentially the $5 fee, but as I understood that we had that for all transactions that are credit card related transactions, so that for everybody that uses a credit card, they're somehow paying a different, whether you call it a courtesy fee or whether you call it whatever you call it, that fee exact is being paid by the individual who is incurring the cost. But you're telling me it's different. You're telling us it's different now.
Mr. Chairman, it is different for those coming in to the court. And according to the credit card companies we have talked to, it's been very clear to us that we cannot charge a convenience fee for that use of the credit card.
But it became different when it started dealing with fines and state government, but maybe that's not the case. We'll check with the Secretary of State and other areas, because I thought we had figured out a way to solve this problem where for state users it's a different rule than for private users for the store out there, but maybe that's not the case. I was under the understanding that we had gotten through that and that every person that pays $100 has a $100 fine, pays a $100 fine, and to the extent that there's a borrowing cost, in a sense, that falls on the particular provider or the user of the card.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to make sure what you would say, that somebody pays at 99 and somebody pays 100. Well, they both end up paying 100 if you go inside the building, because it's a $100 charger in a credit card, or it's a $100 bill out of your pocket. But the court or the schools only receives 99. So it's not so much a difference in what they pay when they go in, it's what's received by the state. And I think that I was always under the assumption that the state or the schools had to receive the $100, not that the person actually were entitled to pay the $100, but the person that was to receive the fine had to get the 100% of the fine. Yeah.
And, Mr. Chairman, we are. We are receiving 100% of the fines, whether you come in and pay by credit card or pay through e-pay.
It's ironic that the people that are making your job the easiest are paying the most.
But it's true.
But anyway. Yeah, they're paying for others. I guess let's take another look at that, because, I thought that, and maybe talk to the Secretary of State and find out what's going on in other systems. I thought we'd gotten over this. I thought that everybody that used a credit card would get a flat charge, and that we'd found a way to do it, and that the credit cards companies acknowledge that states collecting fines are different than the merchants downtown. But
Mr. Chairman,
if I'm wrong on that, it's fine.
If there's a better way to do this, we'll sure talk to the Secretary of State and figure that out.
The idea was that $100 fine is $100 fine in cash,
mm-hmm.
and that's what the foundation program receives. And any cost to any convenience cost for any kind of mechanism should go back to the person paying the fine and not the school foundation program account. But I understand you're saying that the account's being made whole, but it's being made whole by one subset of folks, which I'm not sure if people understood that they'd like it. So, all right. Any other questions on that?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, moving on to page 22, we do start the Wyoming Center for Legal Aid. And on page 23, There is no exception budget request. I do want to point out that this is a new division under the Supreme Court. You may recall in 2010 legislation was passed to allow an additional $10 filing fee for filing fees on cases that come into the court system. That $10 would be set aside in this special revenue fund to provide legal services for financially eligible citizens. Again, those services for civil cases are specific. It's not just any type of a civil case. And we do have Pat Day and Raylan Jobe here from the board of the Wyoming Center for Legal Aid. We do ask that you wait and ask your questions on the center until the end of our presentation in case that you have a lot of questions. The revenue to date is approximately $1.8 million, and the expenditures out of this fund are only $86,000. They are still in the infancy stages, trying to put together the rules, regulations, and the design as to how this center will work in the next biennium. The original appropriation was for $2.5 million. We have kept that as a standard budget. As we move forward, they are looking to provide grants to organizations throughout the legal community to provide services, again, for financially eligible citizens. Mr. Chairman, we now move to the Judicial Nominating Commission, and there is no exception budget request.
Mr. Chairman, this $15,000, I was kidding Joanne yesterday, I don't know why it's $15,001, but that is our standard budget for the Judicial Nominating Commission. Most of you are well aware that this commission functions to select, as part of the Wyoming constitutional process, to select judges. It's a six-member commission made up of three lawyers and three lay people appointed by the governor, and it functions as needed. And it's a little difficult for us to estimate. We know we're going to have some vacancies this upcoming year, and all of that cost is simply for travel to the place where the interviews are held. Generally, we try to hold the interviews where the vacancy occurs, so it's the cost of these six people going around the state as needed. And sometimes we'll go a year without any vacancies opening. I think Justice Voight might have the record that he did six in 1 year or something like that, so we never know what we're going to be facing, but I just wanted to understand what that money went to.
People are leaving like...
Pardon?
He knows what I meant. Going back to the... Yes, you want us to hold off on the questions on the legal aid?
Mr. Chairman, we thought that would just be more efficient because there will be other people involved in answering those questions.
Okay,
so
that's fine. The four, okay. Just... Before we go there, I mean, the four AWACs were always contemplated to be four employees with that program.
There's nothing in the statute that that specifies numbers of employees, and I think the board of directors has worked hard on figuring out what the right structure is.
Are the AWACs, though, providing for an organization, or are they providing legal services?
I'm not sure.
They're providing for, Mr. Chairman, they are providing for the organization. We currently have one, what we call a staff attorney, working for the Wyoming Center for Legal Aid. They are in the process of interviewing for additional attorney positions to help define the rules and regulations.
And, Mr. Chairman, I believe it's contemplated those people eventually will probably be participating in providing legal services, but those are questions I think better answered by the board.
Not the idea.
Pardon me?
Well, as Pat's nodding his head, we'll
yes.
wait till Pat
yes.
gets up and we'll talk to him.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, now on page 28, we begin the law library. If you turn to page 32, we do have a few exception budget requests. We are requesting $9,200 to provide for a maintenance contract on what we call the compact shelving in our law library. To date, we have had to pay maintenance fees by the hour to come in and fix this compact shelving. As you may recall, as we remodeled our building, we moved three floors of books down to one, and this was done by the use of compact shelving. However, that compact shelving doesn't always seem to want to work when we want it to work. It's all electronic. It's very touchy. But this maintenance contract will hopefully be a lot cheaper than paying the hourly fee that we have to do for folks to come in and fix it and fine-tune it. Then, Mr. Chairman, we are requesting $50,000.
Is it outside the warranty already? Or how long has it been since you've been in that building? It was like yesterday.
It does seem like yesterday. October of 2008 is when we moved in, believe it or not.
Time flies when you're
in. Yeah, it sure does.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Next, Mr. Chairman, you'd see a request for $50,000. This is to cover the additional cost on the current collection. The law library did take a budget reduction of $158,222 in this current biennium, so we are not increasing the collection. This is just to cover the additional cost of the current collection. And $12,000 is requested to purchase two copy machines for public use. There are a lot of individuals who need copy capabilities, and so our copiers are getting very old.
Mr. Chairman, question.
Go ahead, Senator Von Flader.
On the equipment repair and maintenance, do you have any idea how much you spent so far on that shelving?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Von Flader, I do not have that number with me. I can get that for you.
And this is a one-year contract is what you're looking at?
It's for the biennium, Mr. Chairman.
So it'll be 2 years.
Yes.
And, Mr. Chairman, my follow-up on the copy machine, do you charge for that, or is that just there available for anybody?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Van Flattering, we do charge for copies for public use, yes.
Is it in any way balanced the amount we're spending for it, or is it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, no, probably not, because we do have employees who use these copiers as well. Then, Mr. Chairman, on page...
Go on there. Oh. With respect to the size of your library and the amount, how do you determine, in terms of the number of volumes and whether you're at an appropriate level? And...
Well, Mr. Chairman, we do leave that up to our state law librarian. We have indication as to what part of our collection is used the most, and obviously those are the books that we continue to keep updated. We have Rhonda Munger, our deputy, has made contact with our law school law library to make sure we are not duplicating services to our citizens, and so between the two law libraries, they do complement the collections available to all citizens.
Mr. Chairman, I might just add, I think it's an ongoing process. As long as there's sort of old dogs like me around who still look at a book, we have some books, but we have less books, fewer books than we used to have, and we have fewer Wyoming reporters and Pacific reporters because obviously most of the new law graduates do all of their research on the computer. So I think it's fair to say that we're slowly bringing the total balance down, but there's still, it's not a science as to exactly how to do that. It's a kind of a constant tension when you have people that are still used to using the books.
On the law school side, they do an evaluation to figure out where they are comparable to other law schools. Do they take your volumes into consideration? Do they take credit for your volumes? Or
well, I'm not
analysis?
Sure how they do it, Mr. Chairman, but we are trying to communicate with them so that we're in line sort of with an industry standard, if there is such a thing, and not duplicate what they're providing.
Thank you. Then, Chief Justice, does the public use the Westlaw in that library, too, so it's a free access to them? So that's part of the program?
Yes, I'm told. The public certainly uses the library, Madam Chairman, and we do keep logs of the number of people that come into the library, and it's really impressive, the number of people that, members of the public that use the library. I'm not personally aware of exactly how many use Westlaw, but I'm sure we keep track of that also.
So that's a benefit to the public.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, yes, we do have two terminals available for citizens to use. We do pay a flat rate. Our law librarians are noticing that a lot of the phone calls that we get are for online research, and they can point individuals to where they might go to find the legal information that they're inquiring about. But we do have terminals available. We do have research tools on their website and those types of things as well.
And then to follow up, do you also pay for subscriptions that are online subscriptions as part of your library costs? Rather than, yeah.
Madam Co-Chair, I am told we still do pay for a few subscriptions. There are a lot of legal materials that just simply are not available online.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, then we will start the Circuit Court Division. And you can see on page 34 all of the Circuit Court subcategories there. We are required by statute to submit one Circuit Court budget, and that budget must be itemized by Circuit Court Judicial District. It would be a lot easier to just combine that into one lump sum, but that is how the statute makes us provide this, and so here it is. I do want to point out the first five subcategories are those categories that are shared by all of the circuit courts, everything from the jury fund, equipment, and temporary services. And I will go through kind of an explanation of these categories for you. You can see from column 7 that we are requesting $43,620. That is the only request you will see, and that will be for copy machines. We have asked our circuit courts to try to make do with what they have. We are very tight, and as you go through here, you will be able to see that. Mr. Chairman, turning to page 36, you can see the number of filings again for the fiscal year 2011, 179,826, and the breakdown of those filings. And on page 37, again, you can see the comparison of filings from 2010 to fiscal year 2011 with the breakdown of the amount of money that does go through our circuit courts on a yearly basis, over $30 million. And a lot of that is in the form of cash.
Mr. Chairman, I might just add there that these numbers, if I'm correct, Joanne, do not include, they ended July 1, 2011, so they do not include the increased jurisdiction filings.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just a question for my own knowledge here. The $4.7 million transmitted to the State General Fund, is that just put in General Fund? It's not designated anywhere. You would not see it otherwise. I notice it doesn't come back as any kind of special revenue for the courts, but I'm not sure how it's handled. Just dumped into the big pot.
What were the sources of the 4.6, different from other fines, obviously?
Mr. Chairman, $4.7 million are the court costs that are deposited through the State Treasurer's Office.
So they just go into the general fund and they're profiled under your goldenrod?
Yes. And the $9.7 million are fines that are transmitted to the county treasurers. And then you can see the $2.4 million was currently deposit into the Special Revenue Fund for Judicial Systems Automation. And then again, the $13 million is in the form of civil judgments, restitution that flow through our circuit court system out to other parties.
Mr. Chairman, question for all, follow up on that. Is the 9.7 what ends up in the school districts, or does that end up as in county funds? And then the special revenue, is that what we'll see when you use revenue in here called special revenue for the agencies themselves? That's money you keep and then show it again as being used for other.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Van Flautern, yes, the $9.7 million, it is my understanding that that goes to local education, and the $2.4 million you will see in our judicial systems automation, that we do cover the cost of all of our IT employees at this time and other IT projects for the judicial branch. That does not include... The $2.4 million does not include the Wyoming Center for Legal Aid at this time because this did end June 30 of 2011, and that additional $10 fee started prior to that. Well, first, Mr. Chairman, on page 39, we start with the Common Jury Fund. We do have, on average, 90 jury trials per year in our circuit court system. An average of 20 jurors are called for each trial. If a circuit court would like to call more jurors, they must call our office for approval to make sure we have the funds available. And certainly there are some high-profile cases that it does require the calling of more jurors. The average cost for jury trial is about $700. We do pay $30 a day for a juror and mileage over 5 miles from the courthouse.
There is, of course, on your special revenue, Mrs. Odendahl, you spend it all on IT. Is that why it's not reflected here as like paying for this with your own revenue? Is it all taken care of in some kind of IT?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Senator.
Is that $30 a day, is that kind of comparable to other states? It seems like, man, that's really low. That's not even minimum wage. How do we get by with not paying minimum wage for a jury?
Oh, is that what it is?
Okay, as long as we don't get a federal lawsuit, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Myers, I believe that's statutory. It's not our choice, obviously, and it is a very low fee, and it is a civic duty. The trial judges here will tell you it's difficult to get people to serve on juries. It's a critical function of our democracy, but when they have a job to go to or a business to run, their $30 a day doesn't sound very good to them.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, moving on to page 41, we have what's called Court Magistrate Special Fund. And I do want to point out a court magistrate is an attorney who has taken an oath to then has agreed to sit for a local circuit judge. In the event a circuit judge is not available, they may have to recuse themselves from a case due to a conflict of interest, or a circuit judge may not be available. So they do ask local attorneys who are interested in being court magistrates to come and sit for them. They are paid $75 an hour. Each individual circuit court budget does have funds available to provide approximately 8 hours a month for court magistrates. This particular fund that is shared by all of the circuit courts is kind of a contingency fund, so to speak, and it is set aside to also cover any court magistrates who are used on weekends or holidays or those types of things. If a circuit court judge vacancy occurs, it can deplete the individual circuit court budget within a month, and so again, these funds would take up that slack. And there is no exception budget request. On page 43, we have the equipment fund that is, again, shared by all of the circuit courts. No circuit court has the ability to just go out and purchase equipment. They must request purchases through our office. All of the requests are reviewed. And by statute, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court must approve all technology requests. This particular budget request is for $43,620 for 4 copy machines, and this is a one-time request. We do require our circuit courts to use their copy machines for at least 5 to 6 years, and until they really start breaking down and it's more costly to have the repairman come in, do we allow them to actually request replacements?
We've had this discussion with other folks as we're all anxiously waiting for the new Craig updates. And so if they come back and we have to start doing cutting, then IT will be looked at, and when we get Stephen up here, we'll talk a little bit about the difference between maintenance and and new initiatives. But in this area, do you have a written policy with respect to how long copy machines are going to last, or you just say, look, after 5 years, call us when yours starts breaking down?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we don't have a written policy, but I do believe our circuit court clerks are very conscious about their copy machines, and unless they are just really giving them fits and it's taking a lot of time, downtime, that it's frustrating when you need court documents to get into the courtroom for the judge. It gets very stressful. So we do try to make these last as long as possible. We don't like to have new equipment in the circuit courts.
Well, I guess on these IT requests, if you'd come back with us and just let us know what the age of the machines are, so we know we're not replacing three-year-old machines. And you've told us that's not the case, but at least, and we'll ask you to do that for just the entire budget, wherever you have IT replacement items. Let's get an aging list so we, if we get into looking at those, we'll have the information available to us. If we say, okay, the cutoff is 4 years, 5 years, and you might have to list them by copy machine, by laptops, by desktops. And, you know, I think that there is a feeling that's maybe not shared by everybody. I mean, we'll find out during markup, but maybe we start looking at laptops going out 4 to 5 years instead of 3 years, and same thing with copy machines. So if what I'm asking for is really a little bit more explanation, justification with respect to individual items, so we could make sure that we're if we decide to extend lives another year, we're not extending the life of a machine that's not working, for example.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, we can provide that information for you. Next, Mr. Chairman, on page 45.
Just because I suspect somebody might ask, with three identically priced copiers and one considerably more expensive in Gillette, why?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, the machine that Gillette is requesting is a little bit, what can I say, beefier, a little faster. It's because of the volume of documents that are copied in the bigger court like that.
Let me ask you that. With respect to the buying of this equipment, we're finding that we're saving a lot of money by going through the CIO's office. Are you using that buying power, or are you off on your own?
Mr. Chairman, as far as the CIO's office, we have met with Flint. We have talked about purchasing equipment, and he and Stephen have had many conversations about purchasing equipment. And we can get to that in the technology section if you like.
Are we going to get it done, or are we going to talk about it?
We've had great conversations, and I think we've leveraged all of our information. And I think the discount.
It doesn't matter if that buying group, whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And make sure Gillette gets a really nice one.
Okay.
Byron we'll can go home and say it's big. We're taking care of it.
I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joanne, do we use local vendors for the purchases of your office supplies like copiers, or do you do use a central state vendor for those purchases?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, we do use local vendors because of the fact that if we do have a problem with that copy machine, it's a local vendor who needs to come and fix it. And we don't expect repair folks from Cheyenne to go all over the state. And yet we do get estimates from local vendors. And so we do try to get the best price for any equipment that we purchase, for copy machines and fax machines. Okay, Mr. Chairman, on page 45, we have the examination of courts. We have two internal auditors whose responsibility it is to travel the state and keep our circuit courts on a two-year audit cycle. And as you can see, with $30 million going through our circuit courts on a yearly basis, this is imperative. When these internal auditors are not traveling, they are auditing the Supreme Court, everything from all of our fiscal transactions on a 3 to 6 month cycle to our fixed assets to other aspects of our processes.
Ms. Chairman, on this auditor, I see in your narrative you talk about that the originally was Department of Audit that worked on this, and then you decided, or they couldn't provide or something, and so you went to an internal audit system. Have you gone back in the last 10 years, 11 years, to ask about doing it that way instead of the $405,000 in your budget? Would we be better off, or would it work and they could provide a two-year audit for your department and for less money? Has anybody looked into that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Von Flattern, we have not looked into it in the last several years. I have a history that I'm not proud of that we share this, but we did have fraud in 25% of our circuit courts. And when we we're working with our fraud audits. It was also realized that an internal audit position would be best suited for the judicial branch. The Department of Audit told us that they could provide the audit cycle on a five-year basis, and we did not feel that would be sufficient enough. Since that time, a new case management system has been installed. We have had one fraud audit since that time. I believe that was in 2004, but our internal auditors make sure we are staying on top of these audits. We do have that ability since they are internal, and to let it go more than 2 years is very risky with the amount of money that does go through our circuit courts.
And I agree with that, the idea of the two-year rotation. But has anybody looked into the department, actually, of audit providing the 2 years? Has anybody asked them, could you do it, and what would it cost us?
Mr. Chairman, again, last time we talked, it was a five-year audit cycle, and I do suspect they have had budget cuts as well. And I did come from the Public Funds Division, and I know they are stretched very, very thin.
I guess the other question then to follow up on that is whether or not it's time to reevaluate whether these auditors ought to be placed in the Department of Audit dedicated to your work as opposed to having your own internal auditors. Let's go. What was the reasoning behind having the – I was there when it happened. I remember funding the positions, but I don't remember the reasoning as to why we would put the auditors in your – within the Supreme Court as a, under your employ as opposed in the Department of Audit with a designation that they do the audits of the judiciary.
Mr. Chairman, at the time, again, the need to keep these audits on the two-year audit cycle, we keep them very busy with auditing of all kinds of aspects in the judicial branch. Again, every transaction that goes through our office is looked at, not every transaction, but anywhere from a 3 to 6 month audit cycle for the Supreme Court. We do put these internal auditors on other projects. They have helped out with the law library, and we keep them very busy. And I guess it's just the separation of duties or power, or however you want to look at it, that we do feel it's imperative to have our own internal auditors to look at the judicial branch and all the circuit courts and those processes.
Well, I assume in that sense that are they auditing only the circuit courts and the clerks, or are they auditing other? They go out to look at. They're not going to get into the clerks for the district court clerks.
You're correct, Mr. Chairman. They do not audit the county clerks of district courts offices. They do audit the transactions that go through the district judges' offices as they come through our office. So we are keeping track of the judicial branch state dollars.
And they, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, they also audit the Wyoming Supreme Court's handling of money and payment of bills. We're happy to talk to the...
Well, I think we ought to re-examine. I mean, let's take the Supreme Court, for example. If you have auditors that are checking your employees, but they're your employees, that's not an audit. I think my sense of it is when we provide these auditors was to give you the resource to go out and check the books, if you will, mm-hmm. before it reaches the Department of Audit. So once it reaches the Department of Audit, then they're going to bring in the Attorney General's office. They're going to make charges, things like that. For having an internal is just a matter of sort of having an internal policeman to discourage people. But having said that, maybe it's time to take another look at whether or not this is where they belong. And it does seem like a lot of employees, I mean, given what the Department of Audit does, and I understand there's a lot of money, but you're just at two people to go around just on circuit courts sounds like a high number. Like a large number of employees for that work, I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we would be happy to talk to the State Department about it and to see how efficient we are or are not. But I think the real push for this was our concern that we could not get the services that we needed to protect this court operations, and we couldn't get them frequently enough, and it was an urgency. And as Joanne pointed out, we had some serious problems that weren't getting caught when the state auditing process was responsible for, because we were a very small squeaky wheel. And I think it's been working very well at this stage. I think we would ask you not to make a change, but I think it does make sense for us to evaluate it and look at the cost effectiveness of the number of employees we have as compared to what it would take for the state office to do the same work.
I don't think we would make a change mm-hmm. this quickly, but it is a good time maybe to take a look at whether or not auditors ought to be in your mm-hmm. shop or whether they ought to be in the Department of Audit where they're more independent. We could reassign the two employees to the Department of Audit and then require a two-year rotation mm-hmm. so that you would get the level of service you wanted, although I'm not sure if service is the right way. You get the level of audit you're looking for. But we could have both. So the question is whether or not, typically you don't have auditors that are under your employee doing auditing functions.
And Mr. Chairman, our internal auditors do report to the Board of Judicial Policy and Administration. Mm-hmm. So we do try to keep that all independent.
The issues, let's just mm-hmm. rethink it and make sure we did it right. Sure. We can always change sure. it.
Okay, next, Mr. Chairman, on page 47, we have a subcategory called temporary services. There is no exception budget request. This particular fund is used to provide summertime assistance to those local communities such as Jackson, Cody, even Rawlins at times. During the summer months, obviously, we have a high tourism rate in those individual areas, maybe not directly in Rawlins, but passing down I-80, they seem to get inundated with traffic citations. So we do provide summertime help. And I do want to say that we currently have two Rover clerks in our office that are traveling to help out in areas all over the state for a week at a time. And so this particular fund is for more of a long-term summertime help, and we have always used every penny of this budget, and so there is no exception budget request, but I do want to make you aware of that.
Back to the teleconferencing, the videoing, the district courts now are all hooked up to a video conferencing system?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
How about the circuit court judges?
Mr. Chairman, you will see in our technology budget that we are asking for additional funds to get all of the circuit court judges the video equipment as well.
Got a utilization record to see whether it's being utilized and whether it's being, going around, I see some judges seem to like it more than the others. I assume that's always the case.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I believe Stephen Durer will be able to answer those questions. Okay, Mr. Chairman, after temporary services, we do start into the individual judicial districts. And on page 49 and 50, we have the first judicial district here in Laramie County, and there is no exception budget request. And I'm not sure how fast you want me to go through these. Okay, go fast. On page 52, you see the second judicial district, which is Albany County and Carbon County. On page 55 is the third judicial district with Lincoln County, Sweetwater County, Green River, Sweetwater County, Rock Springs, and Uinta County. On page 58, we have the fourth judicial district, which is Sheridan County and Johnson County. On page 61, we have the fifth judicial district for Park County, Bighorn County, Hot Springs County, and Washakie County. Page 64 is the sixth judicial district, which is Campbell County, Crook County, and Weston County. Page 67 is the seventh judicial district, which is just Natrona County. Page 70 is the eighth judicial district, which is Converse County, Goshen County, Niobrara County, and Platte County. And finally, Mr. Chairman, on page 73 is the ninth judicial district, which is Fremont-Lander, Fremont-Riverton, Sublette County, and Teton County. And that concludes our circuit court section.
Okay, let's take a break. Let's try to hold it to under half an hour. So 15 minutes, and I really mean it this time.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted this summer we had the opportunity to host a delegation of Vietnamese lawmakers who came, and we've actually been through before with some folks from India and Pakistan, and all five of you were available that time, and they just loved it because in India and Pakistan, you do not get to meet your Supreme Court justice ever, even as a lawmaker. It is a place you don't get to go unless you've been brought up on charges. Well, this summer, the Vietnamese came, and we had Justice Boyd, Justin Goldman, and my good friend Justice Burke were all there, and they all, and the thing that they could not get through their head, and we talked about it the whole time, is why does one branch of the government set the budget for another branch of the government? And they could not get through that. So I was thinking about that all day today.
We sort of wonder that.
I let Justice Burke answer that, yeah.
I said there are two things about that. One is the Supreme Court can't figure it out either.
Sure.
And two, right. When you say my good friend Justice Burke, that gives me worry.
It was a great learning process to hear what their thoughts of the communist government was, of how we'd run our process, and it was an interesting learning experience.
Well, before we there are just a couple things I want to hit on, just generic topics. We've got two bills that are going to come through. We've got one for an additional position up in Sheridan County. They would like to have their judge it, and apparently you would like to have one. And you have the issue of technology. As we move forward in this budget, though, we're going to have to make some decisions. And obviously one is, are we going to create new positions? And that would include judges. And so and this is the last time we get to, or this through month will be the last time JAC sits together. But as a general rule, or maybe as we go into this, are you going to provide to us your studies with respect to your need studies, which would be your utilization studies?
Mr. Chairman, for the new judge in Johnson County, we had not planned to do that. We do have information available that we can talk about generally today, and I believe Judge... Well, first of all, we've got Judge Waldrop here who is going to address some of the details of that position. We have the weighted caseload studies that we can provide you. During the session, you're going to hear that particular district is over a half a judge short, and the facilities are available to for that judge, and you're going to make that request. Now, the total cost of that request, the biennial cost of a new judge, is $900,000 plus. And you will see that as a separate bill with that fiscal note on it.
Well, and generally we've got three big topics. We've got obviously salaries, and as we look to evaluate salaries and whether we're going to provide, you know, we've got everything from teacher salaries all the way up to your salaries. And your point there is that when we were making the evaluation, you lag behind other salaries. And, Joanne, I think you need to give us some information to show us, you know, comparator salaries with respect to the other employers of attorneys, which are generally the AG, the public defender, and some of those, so that we can see that you can demonstrate that you're actually lagging behind. You have the technology that Stephen's going to talk about. And the third, third thing escapes me, but I mean, in general, as we begin to figure out where we're going to spend and where we're not going to spend with less money, if we put more money into technology, oh, then in new positions, actually. So if we're putting more money into technology, why can't we see more technology be utilized so that we have don't have to hire new judges? I mean, I know that Sheridan wants a judge because they like having judges. But it's nevertheless, we have the circuit judges out there. We've got the district court judges. And are we using them the best we can? And are we getting the best bang out of our technology budget before we hire new positions?
Mr. Chairman, let me just say generally, those are legitimate questions. If you look at the salary side of the picture, I think it's fair to say, and we'll provide you with additional detail, but the Hay process showed us that the judicial branch, as a third branch of government, is lagging, and we know that, and it's not a big percentage, but it has not been addressed, and so it's in our view, at least. I know this doesn't probably hear this from every other entity of government, but it is a different animal because it has been set aside, and we are very comfortable that we've got the data to show that, and we can provide that to you. The extra, they're really. I can see in your mind where you're looking at one big pot and it's, you know, either or. In our view, those are three separate and different distinct problems. The additional judge in Sheridan County is justified by the weighted caseload study. The judges, and we'll have an opportunity to talk to you about that in more detail, but we can't provide almost three-quarters of a judge in that in Johnson County for the need that's there in Johnson County with district judges from other locations that are already maxed out. So we think that the data shows that. District judges already move around and help each other all the time when there's a crunch, but there's a steady increase in that county and the facilities are available. In terms of technology, I agree with you, and I'm not sure. It's hard to measure, but it's a chicken and egg kind of thing. We can't increase the efficiency until we make the investment. We've got the investment halfway made, as you'll hear more in more detail from Stephen. So just from a business standpoint, it wouldn't make sense for us to stop that process or cut it back in the middle of it. So we're very hopeful that we don't have to face that. And once that technology is in place, it's difficult to see how you will be able to have less judges, but you certainly can have less support staff. And it won't directly affect whether a judge is available in Johnson County. I think they're a little bit apples and oranges. But those are the three big issues for our branch, is getting our salaries to be commensurate with market and commensurate with the executive branch, getting a new judge in Johnson County, and getting our technology finished, our technology project finished. I think you will see those efficiencies, but we won't see them this year or next year. We'll see them down the road.
Well, we have to be careful. I mean, if you're saying commensurate with market, it may be that we walk out of the session with state employees at 90% instead of 91%. Mm-hmm. And so if you're saying our target is 91 and our state employees fall back a percent because we don't put in salary increases this year, then do we target you at 90? And that's the reason why I've tried to switch the conversation, which is different than we had a year ago. Mm-hmm. I understand that, but I do want to switch the conversation to showing that you're not only not at the same market level as other state employees, but you're lagging behind because mm-hmm. catch-up is different than giving you a salary increase to take you to 91% when state employees may be falling back to 90%.
I think that the data that we have developed with the help of the Hay Group will show you that we're catching up, and that's why we're here asking for it. And so that information will be presented to you and I think is persuasive.
And we need to get that before markups, just so we've got another week and a half.
Good.
Okay, now we got the big spender.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. As you look on page 76, it does give you an indication of the technology division of the Supreme Court budget. You will see two subcategories there. The first listed is court technology. That is a general fund appropriation. And you can see in column 6 that the standard budget is $630,000. Our exception budget request is over $9 million. The next line is judicial systems automation. And you can see the standard budget is $3.8 million with zero exception requests. Obviously, the biggest question in your mind is, why are we not asking for funds or spending authority out of that special revenue fund? We currently have almost $5 million in that fund. We are asking that you let that fund grow over this next biennium. It's obvious to see that over $9 million in requests for our IT projects could not be funded out of the special revenue fund. We will need at least $3.8 million to cover the standard budget request. And as we go through these budget requests, I'm going to turn it over to Stephen and let him explain some of this. But we do have that special revenue fund is the judicial systems automation account that $10 of our court filing fee is deposited to cover technology. In the years past, it has covered the majority of our projects. And you can see that as evidence of line 3 and 4, or column 3 and 4, where over $4 million dropped out, which were one-time requests in the current biennium. So we have tried to fund all of our technology projects out of the special revenue fund, but the income or revenue just is not keeping up with the demand of our projects to move our judicial branch forward. With that,
I ask you then, maybe Stevens, you can just switch the mic, whoever needs to answer the question, but when you look back at your adjustment to base, so you spent $4 million you dropped out, and now you're asking for spending authority for the 3.8. What are we getting for that 3.8? What's it funding, and what are we getting for that?
Mr. Chairman, we would like to wait and go over that as we come to that particular division, if that's all right. That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Stephen Dreher.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stephen Dreher, for the record. I'd like to draw your attention to the timeline, which was page 2 of the handout. The majority of what I'm going to be discussing this morning is actually on that timeline. As a brief history, this timeline was a visual aid. Since technology has so many moving pieces, I guess one could say, and the dollar figures attached, it helps to be able to visualize both the timing of said pieces and also what it is that the courts are working on. It's kind of a pipeline, if you will. I'd like to begin. Actually, first I'd like to explain a little bit of the timeline. The left third, if you would, is previous biennium requests. Many in this room have seen me up at this table, are familiar with some of the projects and initiatives that the courts are working on. To be able to provide continuity to this body and also relate that previous requests to the current biennium requests, we'd like to draw your attention to that. Also, the right-hand third of the timeline is for future requests, things that the courts see on the horizon that may or may not result in a budget request for this body. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to direct your attention to page 78, and I'd like to go over the current and ongoing technology operations. The courts are seeking $2.6 million, which is a one-time request to satisfy all of the critical electronic services for the Supreme Court, all 29 circuit courts, 22 district court chambers, and case management systems for 13 clerks of district court and 7 municipalities. This is not inclusive of the district court case management software, of which I will get to in a moment. I would like to point out, Mr. Chairman, a particular that came up earlier in the conversation regarding the percent of technology budgets relative to other states. If one looks at page SC8, which is the beginning of this budget, the percentage of technology is around 25%. And to clarify that 25%, it includes almost $7 million of one-time requests. So to accurately assess what the impact is of technology relative to other states, we need to exclude those one-time requests of that. It would drop that 25% almost in half by my napkin calculations back here. Just wanted to point that out. The breakdown of the...
Fine. When you give us the assessment, Stephen, go ahead and put that in,
okay,
with and without the one-times, so that we can, when you're comparing that, and I assume you can go to the national conference and they can give you some of this data. And
I'd be happy to.
We just need to make sure we're on target. And then part of the issue, too, always goes back to whether or not there's an appropriate or a level of consolidation that can take place, but and or whether we should be talking about it, because among other things, you don't get to command a lot of other resources that are available, and from other agencies either. So there's no sharing one way or the other. But
Mr. Chairman, you, Senator Nicholas, you raise an important issue, and that is about the consolidation that's happening industry-wide. One of the premises of the courts actually doing consolidation with the clerks of district court. We know that having uniform case management is a prerequisite for electronic filing, but in that context, we're also taking 23 dissimilar organizations and consolidating them down into one. So there is a significant cost savings with that. As the Chief Justice had mentioned, there's a significant investment that actually has to happen as well. Mr. Chairman, Senator Nicholas, you raised another point which I'd like to touch on, and that is about the replacement of notably equipment. The Supreme Court doesn't have an internal policy for equipment replacement, but if I were to not sound too cutesy, it's about running it until the wheels fall off. And typically how that works for computers and I guess you could say hardware resources is that occurs through reprovisioning, where a piece of equipment may not necessarily be appropriate for a critical function in the courts, but it would be critical or it would be sufficient for something that would not be critical. So we're reusing things, in other words. As it relates to the actual equipment replacement, it is by court and by court jurisdiction. The Supreme Court, we put equipment replacement on a recurring cycle. Typically, that's about 5 years. In the district courts, that discretion is left up to the judge to decide when the equipment should be replaced. In the circuit courts, that is also a replacement cycle defined by the Supreme Court. Currently, the workstations in circuit courts, for example, are going on 5 years worth of usage. A little bit more than a year ago, those workstations were recently upgraded, which instead of replacing the equipment, we thought we could get by with a couple extra years of usage, cutting a corner, I guess one could say. Also in the current and ongoing technology operations, one will see a software support and equipment maintenance. This is specific to case management, if you will, and that $1.8 million divided in half for each year in the biennium comes out to approximately $929,000. Of that $900,000, over 70% of that is for software maintenance. To kind of illustrate the degree of magnitude, if you will, that goes into the critical functions as it relates to software versus hardware, and that plays specifically into the consolidation that is being looked at elsewhere in the state. Mr. Chairman, to report, I have met with the CIO's office. We did discuss what's called the WSCA, which is the Western States Contracting Alliance. That's the aggressive pricing schedule that many are familiar with. In doing a topical assessment of that, we actually found out that the courts were procuring equipment cheaper than that schedule. So it was sort of I did. But it was more than $50, and I might just leave it at that. It depends on the computer whether or not it's a laptop versus a desktop. The devil's typically in the details when looking at those aggressive pricing schedules, and most likely it comes into support, the differences in 1 year support versus 3 year of maintenance on those pieces of equipment. As mentioned, we're looking we're seeking $2.2 million to sustain the current and ongoing technology operations. Moving on, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I do want to point out that $350,000 of that request is one-time funds. The 1.8 will be ongoing, and we do hope to move that amount into the special revenue fund after this biennium so that it should be self-sustaining in that particular special revenue account. On page 78, Mr. Chairman, and this is still under priority one.
Mr. Chairman? It's the 1.8 that you're anticipating moving into the special revenue fund?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, because that will be ongoing, and it is the intent of that judicial systems automation account to provide the support for the judicial branch.
Mr. Chairman, moving on to priority two, which is the statewide district court case management system. This body may be aware that this project actually initiated back in July of 2009 in a previous biennium. All of the clerks of district courts got together and nominated amongst their peers a design committee to seek funding for and to meet a prerequisite for electronic filing, and that is the centralized district court case management system. That project is actually doing quite well. It's on schedule, on budget, and is at the conclusion of that particular first phase, if you will, three pilot courts, Albany County in Laramie, Sheridan, and also in Uinta County will be the three pilot courts. That also encompasses the one of four case management systems that are actually in use by the clerks of district court, and that's the migration of that data. With that, the goal is to consolidate and streamline information in the courts at the general jurisdiction level. As mentioned, it's a prerequisite for electronic filing, and it also facilitates a degree of uniformity, which is it assists our organization with statistic capture. It assists the clerks with being able to relate information across jurisdictions. One might recall that this included the design, the development, and implementation in the pilot courts, as mentioned, but it also includes the court processes covering juvenile case types in the district courts. It's a multi-phase project approach. It's divided into releases, and currently we're on release 3 of 5 to conclude in July 1st of this particular year. The budget request that you see in front of you on SC 78 for $2.6 million is also a one-time budget request. That is to complete the implementation in all of the district courts. As mentioned, it's currently going to be in three pilot courts. This will cover the additional 20 courts and complete the implementation in the general jurisdiction, so statewide.
Talk about what we're going to get. With respect to the Supreme Court e-filing, obviously, you can electronically file now with the Supreme Court. Can the public get on and see the briefings?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the public can log on to the website. They can, unless it's a confidential briefing or something of that nature, they can see not only the electronic filing system of the Supreme Court, but they can see the court docket as well.
A document, are they charged for that, or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, there's currently no fees for accessing all of the court content.
With respect to... at the end of the day, with these two pilot courts, what are we going to have at the end of the day with this?
Mr. Chairman, with respect to the three pilot courts at the Clerk of District Courts, essentially what that is it covers a prerequisite, which is uniform case management. To have an electronic filing system, one has to be able to compare apples to apples across these jurisdictions. That currently is not the case in Wyoming. Upon the conclusion of the three pilot courts, that will be the first half, if you will, for that prerequisite. The latter half, of course, is the request of $2.6 million to complete that. How it might be relevant, Mr. Chairman, is that electronic filing is to come thereafter, meaning that once we have case management in all the district court clerk's offices, that paves the way for one electronic filing system to service all of those offices.
Let's talk about the cost. You got $9 million to get to a case management system. Seems expensive, and that's just going to get it for three courts. Then is it going to take us $9 million for every three courts?
Mr. Chairman, $9 million gets us all the way through all of the courts. That's what this the implementation and completion project is those remaining 20 courts. Are you suggesting that $9 million from a prior biennium and this biennium, is that?
Well, we'll get to that, too.
Oh, okay.
Let's talk about the end game. So the end game is so the public can actually get on and see court documents. Documents can be recorded electronically. When do we get there?
We will be there at the completion of electronic filing, which is, if you look at the timeline, e-filing development, which is the red item, Mr. Chairman, is scheduled to begin in January of 2013. That is after the pilot courts and well into the implementation in all of the remaining district courts. To answer the question, when it's actually fully implemented, it would be July of 2014 to have electronic filing and additionally case management system across the district courts.
This funding on your timeline, where does the funding take us to? Where would I draw the funding expiration line?
Referring to the timeline, Mr. Chairman, the current biennium requests are all colorized or in color. And so the red e-filing development would be where the current, or I guess I should say the requested biennium would get us to with respect to electronic filing. there's a little bit of uncertainty out there just because you don't know what you don't know with respect to the e-filing implementation. I put it on the timeline as a placeholder just because we know it exists out there. I don't anticipate that to be a significant cost, more or less just for this group's awareness.
Color coding, and if I draw a line at the end of your January 14, and it dissects your purple and dissects your yellow, or is it the only thing that we haven't paid are the things that are in the white boxes?
Correct. Those have not been paid for nor even sought after. The colorized would be the upcoming biennium requests that we're discussing today.
And what kind of dollar investments are we going to take to get to the uncolored boxes?
Beyond the colored boxes? That would be the $2.6 million, which is the priority two of the current request, Mr. Chairman. Additionally, for electronic filing, there is funding available in the current biennium to be able to sufficient to get that ball rolling as well.
But I'm not. Maybe I'll ask it this way then. I mean, is this the last request that we're going to be made, or the last general fund request to complete the project, and the rest the court automation account can take care of?
Correct. With respect to clerks of district court case management and electronic filing, circuit courts would not be included in that, and I'll get to those in a moment.
Away, and this is for the circuit courts. How about district courts?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we're discussing the district courts or the general jurisdiction courts. When we move into the limited jurisdiction courts for electronic filing, referring to the timeline, that could be potentially in 2015.
Just looking at the numbers in the IT special revenue account, we've got 179,000 cases, 180,000 cases, $10 a case. That's your $1.8 million. You're going to need that. You're going to need half that, I guess, for your data processing, software support, and equipment maintenance. So you've got about $900,000 a year for all your other needs. And is that going to be sufficient in the future, you think?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, we do have in the special revenue fund $3.8 million is the total standard budget request as it is right now.
Right.
Since we are not asking for any funds to be appropriated, additional funds out of that account, we hope that it grows over the next 2 years. Once these projects are in place, we do expect our maintenance for these software projects, the hardware, to be minimal. It's not saying that we won't be coming back for a general fund appropriation. We don't know what kind of impact we will have 4 years down the road. But we do believe that judicial systems automation account should be self-sustaining for our technology.
So you got 5.6 in there now. Your burn rate's 3.8 million, and you're getting 1.8 million in income a year, or 3.6 actually over the biennium. So your burn rate and your income's about the same, and you've got some cushion. But you're hoping you don't have to be back here, but you might be.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, that's correct. I mean, obviously, the $10 filing fee is not sufficient to support all of the judicial projects that take place for the entire judicial branch.
Right.
We are certainly trying to make that accommodation, though.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to draw your attention now to page 79. This is priority three in the technology budget, the statewide circuit court case management system. Mr. Chairman, to provide a brief overview, the current case management system in use in circuit courts is unified in that it's the same manufacturer, the same vendor in every court. It's currently passing its 10-year anniversary. It's been in use since 2002. It's quite resource intensive to maintain and support, requiring 29 individual locations with associated servers, my staff time. It is also not conducive to electronic filing or public access or the recent trends in computing technology such as tablet computing. The capabilities such as electronic filing and public access are actually prohibitive or difficult to accommodate with the current case management system. The anticipated goal is to leverage the work that has been done in the district court arena with the $9 million to approach it with the same methodology as the district court including the gathering, the design, the development, and the implementation. Most likely this would take the shape of a clerk design committee accommodated by our office to be able to proceed with this. The formal discovery actually has already been completed. The deliverables from that, Mr. Chairman, were identified all of the court processes in circuit courts and also provided a high-level tactical plan that would be used to approach the circuit courts. Lastly, there was a gap analysis, and the gap analysis is significant from a cost savings perspective because instead of reinventing the wheel, which has already been done in the district courts, basically the system that will be a product of the district courts will be catered to Wyoming. It will incorporate all the language and the statutes, etc. That work would not have to be done in a circuit court context. It would essentially be added on. It would also be centralized and web-based, and given that it's uniform with the general jurisdictions, that, of course, opens up the door for that, namely the prerequisite for electronic filing. It also includes $400,000 for a data migration and $485,000 for calendaring and scheduling. And the calendaring and scheduling, to clarify, it's directly related to the chamber's processing, specifically in both the circuit and the district courts, and it will provide the tools necessary to automate much of the court docket, such as timeliness and information pertinent to coordinating between the clerk's offices and across the hallway from the judge's chambers. Currently, that's accomplished in a myriad of ways, from a paper process, paper calendaring, to Microsoft Outlook.
And when we start looking at these large numbers for development and migration scheduling, what efforts do you go through to make sure that these are competitive pricing? And typically, we've got the OIs, the CIO saying, okay, he's the policeman to make sure that the agencies are hitting the targets, and I guess you're your own policeman. So how do we know that you're hitting the numbers and that these aren't inflated and that you're getting the best bang for our buck?
Mr. Chairman, the point I'd like to make with respect to cost competitiveness, there is a round of negotiation, if you will. The vendors that produce case management software, unfortunately, don't come cheap. This is consistent. A little tidbit, when I was doing a lot of the research required for the ongoing support and maintenance, I was contacting local county IT in Wyoming, and currently case management software is the number one IT item in terms of the largest IT item in most counties as well. So relative to, we have to be careful what we compare that to with that process. But as of right now, we have a vendor that there's an emphasis placed on having one vendor being able to encompass all jurisdictions of courts rather than trying to piecemeal an approach from multiple vendors and accommodate electronic filing at that point.
But now, with respect to designing the system, are you picking a vendor now that we're going to be stuck with for forever, or is there something about the architect of the system that every few years you can go out and compete among vendors and without having to go through a huge conversion cost?
Mr. Chairman, that's a great question, and as it relates to the vendor, the methodology and the technologies that our vendor is using is open standards, meaning that it isn't proprietary and closed where we would be sort of stuck paying an absurd premium down the road. If I would cut to the chase, the focus is about the data. Once we have the data uniformly captured and collected and maintained, migrating it from an additional vendor in the future would be much more streamlined than trying to take it from all the dissimilar sources at the present. Did I answer your question? Okay. Mr. Chairman, to conclude the priority three, we're seeking $2.5 million, which is also a one-time request. Moving along also to priority four, which is on page 79, we're looking for courtroom technology enhancements. This is a budget request that continues to secure the funding necessary to accommodate judge requests that we receive from time to time, specifically for courtroom technology, and it also encompasses both the circuit and district courts. Examples include audio and visual tools, sound amplification systems, video presentation systems, digital recording, and also accommodations for ADA compliance, such as hearing impaired. This request would update the funding that's appropriated for the current biennium, meaning the one that we're in right now, which has seen funding go to courtroom technology enhancements in Converse, Crook, Fremont, Laramie, Platt, and Teton counties to date. At the time of this budget request, there are actually new courthouse construction projects occurring in Buffalo, which is Johnson County, and Green River, which is Sweetwater. And those would be examples that we anticipate coming in for funding to be available when they, when those new courthouses are opening their doors. I would like to add... Go ahead. Back up on that.
Mm-hmm. When those courthouses come in online, are you participating to say, look, these are the minimum requirements that we're going to require for our IT services?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Typically what happens is our office will either be show up on site and do a building walkthrough. It works out the best if we're involved in the planning process, meaning that if there's a general contractor, they're aware of what the expectations are from the courts. Most of these particulars relating to technology are kind of a give and take, if you will. Some counties are more receptive to providing core infrastructure in a courthouse, such as network connectivity, whereas other courts or other counties are a little bit more averse to that. And our office simply makes up the difference, if you will, to make sure that there's continuity across the courthouses.
Back to the two, Buffalo and...
My understanding is that from a status report recently, the Buffalo courthouse is slightly ahead of schedule because of good weather. In the Sweetwater County courthouse, it's slightly opposite. They're slightly behind. I don't know if it's related to the weather or not.
How's the cooperation going?
Oh.
Are they delivering the technology that we need, or they are or are not?
Yes, at this point they are. Both the Sweetwater County courthouse is farther along in construction where our office would typically come in. We run into typically very little resistance, I guess you could say. Once a local government finds out that you've got money in your pocket, they're usually pretty cooperative at that point. Buffalo Courthouse isn't far enough along to utilize our services at this point. I don't know if I said it, but the amount for Priority 4 for the courtroom technology enhancements is $300,000, which is also a one-time request. Any other questions? Moving on, Mr. Chairman, Priority 5, which is on page 80 of the Supreme Court budget, is the Circuit Court Judicial Video Appearance Network enhancements. Mr. Chairman, I think the question was asked earlier about what about the circuit courts and the usage of video technology. That's specifically what this priority is geared towards. We're seeking $134,500, which is a one-time request to outfit up to 10 circuit courts with this video capability. It is by request only, meaning that there has to be a judge that that wishes to use this stuff. The question was asked earlier about utilization. All of the video nodes, if you will, each endpoint on the judicial branch network is accumulated and quantified, meaning we watch all of the calls that come through. Utilization is a little bit distributed, and by that I mean some judges are more pro-video technology than others. I think that for me personally, one of the things that's been most striking about video usage is the broad usage. We've seen everything from employment candidates to town hall meetings, which the Center for Legal Aid was able to utilize, basically accepting public comment from five different cities in Wyoming at the same time, in addition to routine court hearings. Mr. Chairman, that's correct. These are broadband internet-ready devices. They're a little bit pricey because of the integration piece that they bring to the table with, and integration is just a fancy word that instead of having five or six different pieces of equipment, this particular one piece of equipment performs the functions of those five.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Stephen, can you tell me what the challenges have been for the utilization? So,
Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, typically a challenge would be just getting the buy-off on it. Without speaking for the judges themselves, it's sort of differences, I guess you could say, occur across the judges. They just don't think it's appropriate, I guess one could say, at this time, whereas other judges are looking for every angle they can use it for, expanding the usage of it, placement homes, using it for juvenile hearings, using it for routine witness testimony so that other organizations like chemical testing and just recently DCI, they don't have to have routine travel for if they're subpoenaed. But other challenges that may occur as well, the video technology that we've deployed to the courts thus far has been in a cart-based solution. And it's great for courts that have a lot of room to store a cart. And I don't know if this falls under a challenge, but if a courthouse is rather small, then it may not necessarily be something that would be stationary in a courtroom.
And just to follow up, have you considered using the courtrooms or judges that have really utilized it to cross-train or to spend more time with their peers in showing them the benefits of the program?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, I presented to specifically the clerks of the district court judges this last conference that they had about the video technology, sort of putting the word out. I am aware that the judges do encourage one another. There is, if Judge Skavdal, whom is now a federal magistrate, recently contacted one of our circuit court judges in Sweetwater County, and he was able to appear by video from his iPad into the Judge Forgy's courtroom in video. And so it's sort of the jaw dropper like that gets the technology out and utilized. You'd mentioned a challenge, and I think one of the challenges that's kind of existed for video technology just in general, not limited to the courts, is having somebody to call. And so one of the efforts that our office is focused on is to find those participants. And currently that list is growing as we speak. We recently got the Attorney General's office, and I mentioned DCI earlier, Department of Health, DFS, placement homes like St. Joseph. There's even been some private vendors that now lease this time out. So they've figured out a revenue stream to be able to accommodate participants wishing to communicate with the courts and don't have video capability at that point. Mr. Chairman, moving on, also on page 80, this comes to priority 6, which is the electronic citation grant funding. And to provide a brief overview, this isn't the first time that this body has seen me sitting at this desk looking for money for e-citations. To provide a quick update, my office expects to have electronic citations going into circuit courts from state law enforcement in the near future, hopefully later this year if everything goes well. We're starting with the Wyoming Highway Patrol, and the reason why the Highway Patrol was so attractive is that they produce such a high volume into our circuit courts. Roughly 80% or over 100,000 citations could potentially not have to be keyed in manually by clerks. And I've got Byron Odekoven in the crowd here as well from the Wyoming Associations of Sheriffs and Chiefs of Police. Essentially, e-citations, they eliminate the manual duplicity of data entry between the courts and, of course, other judicial partners such as driver services and DOT. Oftentimes local law enforcement or law enforcement in general has their own clerk that's keying in this information. It also increases the officer accuracy. And so as these officers are collecting information on the side of a road or wherever these citations would be issued from, the electronic tool set makes sure that the officer, one, collects everything that he needs to, and two, it's comprehensive, but also the accuracy so that there's not clerk interpretation. And some officers have better handwriting than others. And lastly, it increases the efficiencies that are shared by multiple organizations, such as timeliness of filing into courts. And a key example of that is that it can take an officer up to, I believe it's supposed to be 3 days, but it can be up, if there's a holiday or a weekend in there, it could be up to 5 days before the court actually receives a citation. You've heard earlier in this conversation about the court's electronic payments. Being able to streamline and to eliminate that timeliness for getting that information into the court allows the court to be able to process the payment a lot faster as well. So a good example would be someone that was pulled over from out of state. They would be able to potentially pay their citation that day as they leave, maybe at a truck stop or whatever that could look like. Mr. Chairman, I would like to point out that the approach for this grant, it is a grant. We took an informal survey, if you will, of the sheriffs and chiefs to see what participation would look like to go into this amount. As I mentioned before, this isn't the first time I've sat here looking for funds, so we actually had quite a bit of documentation from the previous effort that went into this request as well. The actual methodology for the grant, and this is just topical, the participating law enforcement agency would have to actually submit a notice of interest. That would include the areas or the bottlenecks that currently exist in their locality for implementation of electronic citations. The second piece in that process is there would be some court requirements, where we have to assure that the data looks consistent coming in from dissimilar law enforcement, and that would be a standardization piece that the law enforcement agency, as a condition of that grant, would have to be able to provide data to us. Another example would be a uniform statute table. Currently, law enforcement have flipped up across different agencies. They codify and keep track of data differently. That would have to be streamlined and uniform to be able to be put into the courts. Essentially, after the law enforcement agreed with, the submitting agency agreed with those terms, if you will, there would be a response from the grant custodian through the WASCOP, where they would submit an implementation plan. And the key facets for the courts, of course, are the information. However, we have to be able to keep track of the money, and so that would be, that implies that it has to be measured and quantified, and also identified potential risks from the person that's submitting for those funds.
Is there going to be a sharing cost, or are we going to give them 100%, every county 100% grant to get it to the end game?
Mr. Chairman, I've spoken with a few law enforcement representatives regarding that. Typically, when there's a sharing of cost, there's a sustainability crisis that's opened at the end of that, where this technology may be shared to get into an electronic citation solution, but then there isn't the money available at the county level to be able to support it on an ongoing basis. And so we've considered the idea. Nothing's final at this point.
Mr. Chairman.
I still understand the grant. You're going to give how much to what counties?
Mr. Chairman, I've got a detailed breakdown of the participants that actually replied to this. Essentially, it varies by county. Being that law enforcement is in different places everywhere you go, it really, there is a lot of variance anticipated in this. I haven't taken a streamlined, equitable approach, I guess one could
pretty
say.
Pretty much if you call everybody and said, we're going to give you something for free, they're all going to put their hands up.
Unfortunately, not all of them have, Mr. Chairman. Some of them said that, you know, thanks, but no thanks, I guess you can say.
There you go. Well, I guess we need to see that list. We're going to doesn't make a difference, Ray. Go.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Our neighboring state to the north utilizes the e-citation. You know, I was interested to see if it was going to work and how it worked. I had the opportunity last month to find out personally how it worked, and it works quite well, Mr. Chairman, really.
No, Mr. Chairman, actually I haven't had that great joy. Just maybe a techie question. What exactly is this going to require of the officer standing next to the car? I mean, is there technology that they're going to have? And then also, does that mean it's instantly going to go into a system real time? So if the person goes two counties off and gets another speeding ticket, the officer can see that 45 minutes earlier this person had gotten a ticket? You see what I'm asking?
Mr. Chairman, that's a great question, and that is actually one of the focal points that this system would be conducive for, is the ability for a potential offender to be pulled over in one county or city, for that matter, if this were introduced in the cities, which we're not seeking for the cities yet. But if it were, I know that's where the hole exists, where a second officer, if that individual was pulled over going down the interstate there slightly thereafter, would be able to know, well, this individual was pulled over recently. Byron would be able to go into a little bit more detail into the actual procedural elements. What the technology looks like for the officer is typically a PDA or a laptop device. There tends to be a little bit more emphasis on the laptop device, or what's called an MDT, which is essentially what we've seen in Cheyenne, where the officers have a laptop in their car, because of other tools that are available to the officers, such as global positioning, and also to be able to query with dispatch. And so they can coordinate all of their officers on shift at the same time through the same interfaces. Did that answer your question, ma'am?
If I can ask another question, and this is not going to be, I don't know if we're done, if anybody has any other questions. Okay, I just had one other question when we were talking about the case management system, and the good chairman asked the question about if the public can get into it, and you said yes, but they have to log in. And I know other states, like Missouri has CaseNet, which allows you just to search by last name, any court. You don't have to know what court, just if you were looking for someone or... what are you requiring when people have to log in here? Are you asking for their email address? What personal information do they have to get the information?
Mr. Chairman, for the Supreme Court electronic filing system, there actually isn't a credentialing process unless one is going to file into the court to retrieve or review those documents that have already been filed into the court. There is no registration. And, Mr. Chairman, it's sort of a tricky business. We've seen where information is valuable stuff. And particularly as it relates to court information, because if I'm a vendor and I could obtain all of the electronic filings in Wyoming, I can then turn around and sell that. and maybe not even pay Wyoming any royalties. And so it's kind of a delicate line, if you will, what's available to the public for free that other vendors are actually picking up and selling versus something that may be recoverable for the state of Wyoming. But, again, that might have to be something that's addressed at a future date. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, one further comment. It was directed by this body in the past when electronic filing was coming into fruition that it be as accessible to the public as possible, and we've tried to adhere to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm interested in the potential for reporting or queries on the information that's collected. I know a few years ago, I can't even remember exactly what the issue is, but we were trying to find out how many people had been arrested for a particular thing, and it was like impossible. No way to figure it out. Is this going to give us that kind of information that could be pulled together in some reporting fashion?
Mr. Chairman, with being mindful of making promises sort of on the spot, the data, if you will, is the goal of a lot of this, and that is to be able to coordinate and aggregate and report statistically on that data. Just for awareness, the courts, our office, currently have a statewide courts data warehouse. We call it the Statewide Court Information Store. Currently, that data warehouse only encompasses circuit courts. It depends on the data that one's trying to accumulate and quantify. If it includes municipal data, there's going to be gaping holes in that, and that's my understanding is that that's where the holes exist primarily, specifically for initiatives such as tracking repeat DUI offenses, as mentioned, having a routine or a multiple offenses in the same day. But to answer Representative Wallace's question, yes, data and the statistical elements of this is sort of the beef that policymakers are after, as are the courts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my question is, there is a balance sitting in your special revenue fund. You wish to let the balance ride for the biennium. You're asking for general funds to supplant that to the tune of $9.3 million, give or take. And this standard budget of $630,000, that, I guess you go back to about page 80 or something, it gives you 82. Page 82, I guess it's just the overhead of that department. I assume what the 630 is, takes care of the overhead. Could you explain what the base budget on page 76 of 7.9, where did that number come from? And then you adjust it down by 4 million. And I guess page 82 or 3 or something gives us an explanation of what the next $3.8 million is going to be spent on. But where did the 7.9 start out? I guess I'm a little confused there. And one other question. Do you have a minimum that you keep in that account that you don't want to expend?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Von Fladern, if you turn to page 85, that might give a little bit more detail for you for the Judicial Systems Automation account. If you look in column 3, it is the base budget, and you can see how funds were appropriated in this current biennium. If you look at column 4, you see the adjustments that come out. Code 0242, the $3.5 million drops out. That is probably for equipment, software development, those types of things. Other items have automatically dropped out because they were probably one-time requests. And so then we come to column 6, which then is the standard budget of the $3.8 million. So that's how we're going from the 7.9 down to the 3.8. Again, one-time funds do have to drop out for the next biennium. Now, we do have the obligation then for that 3.8 to be ongoing. The $10 filing fee is not sufficient to stay on top of our standard budget and all of these additional projects that we would like to stay on top of and finish, especially the Clerk of District Court case management system. That it should be the final phase in this next biennium 2013-14 budget. We will want to continue on so we don't lose our momentum for the Circuit Court case management system, as Stephen indicated. We do want that account to grow so that we can can be self-sustaining and have it grow exponentially. The interest that is also added becomes part of our spending availability to us. And so over time, we're hopeful that that account can then get back on track again, because in the past, we have tried to provide all of our projects, the majority of our projects, out of that fund. But in the last 2 to 4 years, it has been an extreme impact on that particular fund.
So follow-up to that, Ms. Chairman, is there a balance, roughly $5 million left in that account right now? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, there is approximately $5 million. We still have 6 more months of this current biennium to get through. We do have obligations for some contracts. As Stephen mentioned, the e-filing piece of the district court case management system has been funded in this current biennium, and so we plan to sign a contract. And so some of those funds are already earmarked for projects that will be ongoing and encumbered, so to speak, to finish in the next biennium.
So are we we're supplanting some of that funds with general fund money, doing it today versus doing it next biennium and next biennium? I mean, that's what we're doing. We're doing an offset with general funds versus the special revenue funds. Is that correct?
Doing it
today instead of doing it over the next couple bienniums.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Because of the momentum that we want to complete these projects, we do need to request these funds now. That account cannot provide for the $9 million in our requests.
But we could offset some of the general funds with some of that. Combination of the two could keep you moving as you have predicted on this chart.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, Ms. Chairman. So I want to make sure I understand this chart, too. The colored areas on this chart are what we are funding in here. And you're hoping that your special revenue account will take care of the white areas in the future. Is that correct, or your best guess it will?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that is our best guess. This diagram pretty much just shows you what we've accomplished in the previous biennium, what we're requesting now, and what will probably be requested in the next biennium.
Requested or offset? Possibly taken care of by your own revenue, or definitely going to be a request?
Right. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
A little of both. Okay.
Yes. Combination.
A budget for the two biennia out, so you could sort of show what you're doing and put in beginning account balances, ending account balances, so we could see what the plan is for really for 4 years, and it might put this more into picture. I think the gist of it is that it's okay to build your account for some purposes, but not for other purposes. And if we're allowing you to build it, the account now to offset to make sure that the account or the projects are completed, and develop enough strength so you don't have to come back to us, that's fine, but you need to give us a, why don't you give us a 4-year fiscal profile on that so we could see it, we'll have a memory of it, and I guess we're going to let you build, if we honor the request, then you're going to build your own little trust fund, but that's fine. I mean, if I'm sensing you expect to be fully expended through in 4 years. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So maybe just give us a 4-year fiscal profile. And then, Stephen, with respect to the other items, to the extent that you have a spreadsheet that show how you built your requests, maybe assemble those for us so that we can kind of see what the breakdown is of your components.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, are we going to start that chart based on reflecting the inception of July 8th with what we appropriated initially, so we know the whole package?
Well, I think yes and no. I mean, I don't know that you have to the extent that it's easy to show us a historic what the whole package is going to cost us, but in the end, it's going to be a lot of money. I mean, that's,
we could if it helps. A lot of money.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's commensurate to what we paid for the state engineer.
Right.
You know, if we look back at our total budget, and some other there, I think it's worthwhile historically knowing what's our investment in it. What's our, I mean, the good news is it looks like we're getting towards the end. And the better news will be that we can actually deliver these documents online. And so people can see their records. The better news even after that is if the courthouses would find out this is doable and get all of your public records online. And there's no reason why. I mean, if you're sitting down in Colorado, you can call down, you can get online and see what what properties are selling for, what you can get deeds online. It's all available, and frankly, we should be the same place, but maybe this helps people, teach them how to get there.
Mr. Chairman, one more question.
Go ahead.
On the e-citations, will that actually eliminate a step in the process and therefore possible lesser employment, lesser employees?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Von Fladern, e-citations has a number of doors that it will be opening. In terms of does it eliminate steps, that I don't know. I would certainly have to defer to Byron in terms of if it's steps for the court versus steps for law enforcement. At the present, we're trying to duplicate the existing process, if you will. And so if the process has a certain amount of steps, such as supervisors having to oversee the ticket books, if you will, that piece is preserved.
Thanks. Stephen, have you worked on best practices with other states that are implementing this program so that you're utilizing the most efficient manner of putting this in place?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, in terms of best practices, I don't know if I would presume every state has their own best practices, I guess you could say.
Yes.
There are that's a combination of both what the vendor brings to the table and also what Wyoming's needs are. And I do want to be a little bit vague if I can, just because I don't quite know what the best practices would be in terms of implementation. A good example of that is if I'm an officer standing on the side of the road and I'm speaking out of my court turn, but if I'm able to walk up to a car with an e-citation device that actually takes a picture of the driver, and he can scan a VIN and he can actually run an insurance check on the vehicle based on the VIN, etc. Things like that are being considered and modeled after other states. But in terms of the internal procedural stuff, I don't quite know what those would be.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes my portion of this presentation. As mentioned on page 81, the total exception budget request is $9,361,500.
I'm sorry, the 626 code, I didn't see that, and if I missed that, I'm sorry, for $1.5 million on page 81.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hastert, that 1.5, which is the 626, is on page 82 under grants. Towards the bottom, you can see it in column 7.
Incorporated inside the 600s. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, if you turn now to page 87, we have a judicial retirement account that we refer to it as the old retirement account. Any judge who was hired prior to 1998, July 1, they were in a justice or a district judge, were put into this old retirement account. Since July 1 of 1998, now all judges are placed into a judicial retirement account that is administered by the state retirement office. We still do currently have 16 of retired judges, justices, or surviving spouses in this particular account. We have no exception budget request. Are there any questions on judicial retirement? Okay, then, Mr. Chairman, finally, we are to the Board of Judicial Policy and Administration request on page 91. And this, again, is a budget that covers the entire judicial branch. So the Board of Judicial Policy does meet approximately 4 to 5 times a year, depending on the number of topics that they have to discuss. When talking about video appearance, we are able to save money now in travel so that some of the judges in different corners of the state are able to appear by video, and we save approximately $3,000 for each meeting. It keeps our judges off the road and back in their courts, able to do business a lot easier. We are requesting $1.7 million for salaries classified, and again, the breakdown, as you can see, is approximately $1.5 million to get Supreme, but judicial branch employees to the 91% of market based on the Hague Group study. $173,000 is requested to provide merit increases for those employees who are maybe between 91 and 100% of market that have been with the system for a long time, and judges feel that those particular employees are outstanding in their performance. So a total of the $1.7 million. We've already had some discussion pertaining to this, so I don't know if you have additional questions.
Let's talk about the merit pay. On the merit pay, is that going to be one time or is that going to be ongoing?
The merit pay will be ongoing, Mr. Chairman.
A standard, or the judge is going to decide on their own how to do that?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the majority of these funds being requested are to the district judges because they do have some judicial assistance. We also have some attorneys who are between 91 and 100% of market. It will be based on performance with the supervisory of the particular judge or justice of that employee.
Well, I mean, if let's break out JA's judicial assistants who are non-lawyers versus law clerks. You know, I could see where you can justify it on years of service. That ought to be built in their pay. If you have an adjustment because they're in Teton County, for example, for cost of living, I can see a regional cost adjustment. If you had a methodology, but simply saying that a judge in Gillette would like to afford more pay increase for his just JA because this is the best JA in the state. I mean, is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, I should not have just said JAs. I mean, the majority of these pay raises are for attorneys throughout the judicial branch.
And then, so you have 10 lawyers around the state, and they're all seven-year lawyers, and one of them happens to be a rocket scientist, and the other one's not. If you're in the Attorney General's office, and there might be 20 lawyers, say, that are all 7 years, and some of them are a lot brighter than the others, if you want a merit pay that actually assigns merit, determines their merit, and pays them for productivity, fair enough. But if we're going to implement that into the judicial system for law clerks, you have to say not only are you a rock star, but you're performing like a rock star. So that how do you even know whether a clerk in Gillette's working harder or less than one in Laramie?
Mr. Chairman, that is up to that particular district court judge. The district judges will get together after this session and decide how those pay raises will be administered for their employees.
Well, Mr. Chairman, may I add something? So, if I'm correct, Joanne, some of this is not all to the district court. Some of it goes to the Supreme Court. I mean, we expect that the supervisor of these lawyers will be the ones determining whether the performance is such that it justifies additional compensation. We can't say that for all the district judges because we.
But there again, if it's merit pay, we're wrestling the same thing on the executive branch.
I know.
So if it's merit pay, you pay merit for somebody that's gone beyond the expectation and entitled to it. You don't build it in simply because they're a rock star, because next year they don't work as hard, and now you've got the merit pay built in.
But well, I understand where you're coming from. We don't have I speak for state government, but I might not be. The one-time bonus concept has not been sort of part of the operation of, I don't think, any of the branches of government.
It developed. I mean, I don't know where we are in A&Is, but merit pay, I guess what we've told A&I is bring us a merit pay plan and we'll fund the plan, but we won't just give money for merit pay without a plan to distribute.
Well,
and maybe we come back to the same thing with you folks saying, look, if you really want a merit pay plan, then develop the plan and show how merit pay is going to be delivered, and then we fund the plan as opposed to simply saying, look, you're no different than than the rest of us. I mean, when you work with people closely, you develop special relationships, and those special relationships, you may think law clerks are overpaid, except for your own law clerk, and he's always underpaid.
Well, some of these positions, as you and I have discussed, if you go through the Hay Group analysis and you'd get the 91% of market, you know that critical employee who is below that you can't get along without. Now, whether that's, you want to call that merit pay?
Thing. I mean, if you're saying, okay, we've got an employee who doesn't fit in the category. Let's take IT services. We've had occasions where our pay grade simply wouldn't allow us to hire, maintain, and recruit. Now, if you're saying, look, what we want to do is we've got some extraordinary lawyers that were law clerks out in working for judges, and the judges don't want to lose them because they want to pay them more. They don't, and private practice is luring them out. That's just part of the system. I mean, we can't pay everybody to stay in state government, and you can't say, okay, well, here's a lawyer that's up in Gillette that's been a law clerk for 9 years, 10 years, an extraordinary law clerk, and has been offered a job in private practice, and in order to keep him there, we're going to have to pay him more. I mean, if that's what you're talking about, I don't know that we're prepared. I mean, don't let the door hit you. Go get your job, mm-hmm. and then we'll bring up some new clerks.
Well, it's really, I mean, we can provide additional details to how we calculated the 173, I think it is.
Let's give us the details. Show us what you're doing with it. When I heard merit pay, I think a merit plan,
right.
One-time bonuses, things like that, fair enough. But if you're talking about, well, let's talk about X-band, you can be an X-band employee in this executive branch and be paid consistent with other X-banded employees. But we typically don't pull out one. If you have a group of, say, five attorneys that are X-banded, we don't pull one out and say, okay, you get more than everybody else, unless their job title or their supervision or something commands that extra salary. So I'm not sure what you have in mind, and maybe if you give us the detail and so we can better understand it.
We can do that.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, and I do want you to know I have been in conversations with Dean Fawcett of the HR department for the executive branch a couple of times. We are on target with the same theory that they have used. This is very consistent with what the executive branch has done. So, on both sides, actually. Yes, Mr. Chairman. All of the employees, or I should say, there's only a handful that are still for-cause employees. Since 2001, any employee hired in the judicial branch is considered at will and can be terminated for any reason at any time. So if we have employees who are not performing to the expectation of that direct supervisor, the judge, justice, or whatever, that employee is gone. And so these employees are working to the best of their performance. We do have situations from time to time where the case impact is different in different areas around the state. And so we do have employees that are impacted from caseloads. But yes, Mr. Chairman, we have looked at an overview again. We just received this information from the Hay Group at the end of November, and so in this corrected budget, you have our corrected numbers. We've done a preliminary review. We have not had the opportunity to sit down and actually go through every single position as fine-tuned as we want to. You had at one time mentioned, Mr. Chairman, had I brought into consideration the cost of living index across the state. And should a circuit court clerk in one location be paid the same as in another? In looking at that, again, with the A&I, the cost of living index is only a little lower in probably Platte County and Goshen County. So those calculations have also gone into this final number. But the majority where the cost of living index is higher, obviously the housing allowance comes into play, and so that is not part of this. But we have tried to be consistent. The housing allowance, I don't have the individual locations, but it is the same as what's provided to the executive branch. We do nothing different. Okay, so Mr. Chairman, that is the salary request. Next, you will see the $388,000 to cover the additional employee benefits on those salary increases. The next, Mr. Chairman, is $112,000 in professional fees. $100,000 of that request is on behalf of the Wyoming Court Security Commission. From time to time, there are high-profile cases, and local law enforcement is really impacted by paying law enforcement officers overtime, asking additional officers to be on the clock, so to speak. And so this fund would reimburse those local municipalities, local sheriff's departments, for that overtime cost in high-profile cases. Your representatives and senators on that court security commission are Representative Botten and Senator Perkins. Also, within that $112,000, we are requesting $12,000 to cover the increased cost for drug court magistrates. You may remember in this current biennium, any officer of the court should be paid through the judicial branch. So we took those funds that were usually appropriated through the drug court grants through Department of Health and put those funds into the judicial branch. And so those hours are reported to our office and paid from the Supreme Court. Next, Mr. Chairman, $113,280 are requested for special projects and services. And by the code 0903, this is a code that will drop out in the next biennium. So this is a one-time request, even though it's not mentioned there. That code identifies this as a one-time request. $85,000 of this request is to do the time study for the clerks, for the district judges and circuit judges. You may remember last year in the supplemental budget request, we came and asked you for the funds to do the clerk time study. Both studies were done 5 years ago. Changes have been made in the processes of the court. Obviously, now the civil jurisdiction level was increased. And so we wanted to be able to do these studies in the next biennium to see what the impact has been on our judges. And so $85,000 is requested for that. An additional $28,160 is requested to be made available to our district judges so that they can survey their own docket to see what their time to disposition is, if there are cases that they have the ability to clean up, so to speak, or get off their docket before the transition of their current data into the new case management system. We want to allow them the opportunity to do that. This is a good tool for the clerk, for the district judges, and so this amount of money would be available to any district judge who is interested.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just add a little supplemental information, this time study, making it accurate and updating it, might not sound like a big deal, but it's really important to us. It's important to the way the judicial branch is managed. The judges, I think I can not be putting words in their mouth to say they hate it. They hate doing it. It's an imposition, but it is the only way that we can really get it accurate and make it as accurate as possible for decisions like where do we need a new judge or where do we need new resources. So it because of that change in jurisdiction, our current time study isn't going to be accurate unless we update it. So it's an important request.
Who do you use for a vendor or provider to do the assessment?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, we do use a lady by the name of Karen Gottlieb. She is out of she used to work for the National Center for State Courts. She is out of Denver. She has been doing these consistently since, I believe, 1999. So the methodology has been consistent. And with that, Mr. Chairman, we are finished with our presentation. We do have, again, Pat Day and your former colleague, Raylene Job, available to answer any questions you might have on the Wyoming Center for Legal Aid. Are there any questions? Are there any questions? Well, I guess you're off the hook. Oh,
why not? Yeah. Got up early.
There is no explanation, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Okay, Mr. Chairman. You want me to sit back?
No. Oh. Don't you move.
Mr. Chairman, please don't screw with me. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Wade Waldrop. I am a district court judge in the 2nd Judicial District in Carbon County. With me to support an exception request and to provide support for me is Judge Brooks from Douglas. I also serve as the president of our district judge conference. Each district judge is a separate and independent state agency. We are not supervised by the Wyoming Supreme Court. They are good enough, however, to loan to us Ms. Odendahl, which is the only thing that gives me the confidence to sit up here in front of you at all. I want to take just a moment and tell you what a district court judge does. I know Chief Justice Kite has told you a little bit. We are known as the general jurisdiction courts. It's difficult to compare a court from one state to another. What is a district court in the state of Wyoming can be a circuit court in the state of New Jersey. The one way you can compare them all is limited jurisdiction and general jurisdiction. General jurisdiction means that there is no cap on the level of circuit or civil cases that we hear, and we hear all of the felony criminal cases brought before us. In this state, we hear all divorces, all domestic matters, all custodies, all paternities. We hear juvenile court abuse, neglect, child in need of supervision and delinquency cases. We hear termination of parental rights cases. We hear involuntary commitments and appeals from lower courts, circuit courts, municipal courts, and workers' comp appeals. Each budget, our process is that each district court judge cooperates with Ms. Odendahl and supplies his or her budget. Then our budget review committee reviews each exception request by every district judge. The budget review committee is the outgoing president. In this year, that's Judge Young out of Lander. The current president, that's me, and the incoming president, currently Judge Arnold out of Cheyenne, which results in the product that you have in front of you. There are three big issues. We believe there are three big issues for you today. One is court interpreters. The Department of Justice has required us to develop a policy regarding our use of interpreters during trials. We have done that, or rather Ms. Odendahl has done that. It has been passed by the Board of Judicial Policy. And we are requesting $4,500 for each court based upon that new interpreter policy. And in a moment, I'll make Ms. Odendahl available to answer any questions you might have. We have a hodgepodge around the state of how we treat those interpreters. In some jurisdictions, counties pay for the interpreters. In some, it comes out of the judge's budget. This will make court payment of court interpreters uniform throughout the state, and they'll be paid through the district court budget. We're asking you for $4,500 per judge as a place to start. We're not sure if that's enough. Perhaps, we don't believe so, but perhaps it would be too much. The request is not a static request. It's fluid. We may have one trial with Gillette almost had a case go to trial. It pled out, but I think there were five criminal drug defendants, all non-English speaking. As you can imagine, that would have cost a lot of money. I'll curse myself by saying it. I've never done an interpreted trial, so I don't need the $4,500. It is available to move, as I understand it. Ms. Odendahl can correct me if I'm wrong, but if they have the high-profile case in Gillette, she'll be able to rob my $4,500 and help them pay it.
pool dollars to allow the either Joanne or the conference to distribute it out.
Mr. Chairman, that would be an opportunity for the district courts. However, each, as Judge Waldrop indicated, each district judge has their own budgets. It was just a line item for each district judge.
Is there a mechanism out there to pool DJ numbers? There's no entity out there other than in the Supreme Court to pool the money.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. That's why that Board of Judicial Policy and Administration covers the umbrella, so to speak, for the entire judicial branch. That would be a place where you could provide that interpreter fee amount if you so wish.
But if we wanted a line item in a budget, your budget's the only one that affords us to do a line item, and we could say by policy it gets distributed out by oversight of the conference.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Why did you choose one over the other? I mean, would you prefer to have it in one line item and make a request, or do you want to have it buried in everybody's budget?
Mr. Chairman, it was just a decision that was just made this way. It can go either way.
Well, if we put it in each's budget, then you have flex authority to go into those accounts so that we build that $4,500 into all the DJ's accounts. Then, by statute, you've got a flex authority to move it from one account to another. So by putting it in one account, then we keep better track of it, and it lessens the likelihood that it gets moved from or essentially flexed around. Judge, how much flexing do you do within your accounts?
Almost none.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Most of the salaries, you can't flex it.
Right. Mr. Chairman, as you go through these district court budgets, you will see that most of our district courts function overall on anywhere from $20,000 to $25,000 a year. So we're not talking about a lot of availability to flex from 900 series to 200 or what have you. So their budgets are tight. They never know from year to year what kind of cases they will have. You will hear from time to time we have death penalty cases, which really deplete the budgets of our particular district courts. So it fluctuates from year to year.
Whether or not it's put in a single account, create a new series for that, and then you request it when you need it, or it's supposed to have it in your individual budgets?
Mr. Chairman, because of the fact that I don't rob one line item to pay another, I personally don't care. I'd leave that up to the committee on how you prefer to do it.
Problem is that, I mean, there is a, if we're putting more money in to create another program and you've built it into all the DJ courts, you're going to have different policies with respect to how it's utilized, and some judges will flex it for other purposes and some judges will use it for the intended purpose.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can tell you that in our circuit courts, you will see individual circuit courts with that budget amount. We average, I think, 6 hours a month for interpreter fees. It is consistent in the circuit courts. In the district court, it was all over the map when we did our survey. Like Judge Waldrop indicated, some clerks of district court have paid for interpreters, some district judges. This is just more streamlined.
Within a circuit court, circuit court judges don't have flex authority, I assume. It's not their budget. Only you can flex those in a circuit court judge, whereas we get to DJs, they've got flex authority, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
But it's a little bit different in the sense that if we put a money in for interpreting in a circuit court, you reach down and flex it if you need it, and you know that the only flex authority can happen through the Supreme Court authorizing it, whereas we put in the DJ budgets, they can flex it. If they don't see a use for it and they find another purpose, they can put it into books. They can put it into courtroom amenities, whatever they want. Well, just a thought. I mean, between now and Mark, I've given it some thought. I mean, we can decide what to do. But if you don't really care, I'd be inclined to keep it or advocate to my colleagues to keep it in a pool.
Mr.
So we
Chairman,
can see it in the pool.
With your permission, I'd like to survey my colleagues and see what their preference is.
That, and then I guess the question is if we do want to lump it and keep it together, do we find a vehicle to do it? You could do it in one one judge's budget, or you could do it in the Supreme Court, or you could we could figure out another line item. You just have to have an agency to line item or put it in. I suppose we could create a budget for the conference.
Mr. Chairman, I would direct your attention to page one of the budget, which is our overall summary from the District Court Budget Review Committee regarding our budget requests.
Mr. Chairman, you will notice on this memorandum to the Joint Appropriations Committee, right underneath the exception budget request, you will see that all of the interpreter fees have been lumped together for a request of $99,000. But as Judge Waldrop goes through the individual budgets, you will see it separated as $4,500 in each budget. So for the sake of making this memorandum a little shorter, they've been lumped together.
I'd like to take a moment, Mr. Chairman, if I may. You raised some questions about you and the co-chair about the use of video in district courtroom. I am one of the judges that aggressively uses video presentations. I use it a lot in juvenile courtrooms, from a boy who might be at the boys' school, somebody at St. Joe's, all around the state. I use it particularly with inmate appearances before me from either Torrington or Rollins. It saves a lot of money on two officers bringing an inmate before me personally, as well as the travel that occurs quite regularly between the Torrington facility and my Rollins courtroom. So I believe it saves a lot of money. I believe in particular in juvenile court, it allows a family to see one another when they might otherwise not be able to do that. So I'm a big proponent of the use of video in our courtrooms. There are technical issues that we need to work out. What can you do in a video and what can't you do? Right now, where I draw the line is if it's an evidentiary hearing, we don't use video. But if it is a pro forma arraignment, for example, with an inmate who's going to plead not guilty, and it sure saves a lot of money and sure saves a lot of security headache by being able to do it by video. So I commend that for your... I think they have the same kind of cart system that we have right now. In Rollins, they use the parole hearing room. I'm not sure what room they use in Torrington, but I can tell you it works very well.
In the one at Corrections, or does Corrections maintain their own?
Mr. Chairman, I think that leads us, our big exceptions are, and I'll tell you about them now, and then I'll go over each agency with you, but our big exceptions are $100,000 for the Bighorn Water Adjudication Project, which you've been familiar with at least throughout my entire adult career. We are requesting a car for Judge Tyler in Sublette County, and we are requesting a law clerk for Judge Brooks. They haven't. And, Judge, we have a policy. The Board of Judicial Policy requires a judge to travel at least 10,000 miles a year in order to qualify for a vehicle. Judge Tyler has presented before the Board of Judicial Policy. He's qualified. He travels more than 10,000 miles a year. And we support his request for that car. As you know, Judge Tyler travels all across the state. He is a workhorse, and he hears cases in Lander, Jackson, Cody, and everywhere else, Gillette, as far as that goes. So, Judge Brooks is the only district court judge who does not currently have his own law clerk. I won't take up all your time telling you all the myriad of ways that we use a law clerk, but I will tell you that a law clerk enables us to provide a quicker, much quicker, and better service to our client base. We get quicker opinions out with a law clerk than we do otherwise.
I thought he had a clerk. Has he never had a clerk, never had a budget?
He shares a clerk with Judge Kelly.
Oh, that's right.
But that clerk lives in Torrington.
So you'll end up with a clerk both places.
That's right. Each judge would have his own clerk. And again, Judge Brooks is the only district court judge that does not have his own clerk now.
before we go into the agencies, am I forgetting anything?
I don't think so.
Ms. Odendahl has tutored me twice on how not to offend you and not to screw this up, and I've tried very hard to listen to her. at least one was. Okay. I direct your attention, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to page 8. That is Judicial District 1A, Judge Campbell. And there is an exception request of $11,500. That's for a copy machine and the use of interpreters.
And again, that copy machine is a one-time request.
Mr. Chairman, correct? On page 7 before, this is why I'm asking it now, there's the line in the middle that says revenues generated by collection of standby or statutory reporting fees. Just curious where the money goes. Is it dumped in a lump sum into our general fund or, you know, what happens?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Any funds collected by the district judge's office or what have you are put into the general fund. And those fees are mostly for transcripts.
Well, that takes us, Mr. Chairman, to page 18. Excuse me, I've skipped one. And that is 1B on page 14, Judge Davis in Cheyenne, with the court interpreter exception request. And you will see that request in every agency, every court, every judge. Next, we have Judicial District 2A on page 18. That is me. You'll see total exception requests of $11,000, $2,500 in-state travel, $1,000 in supplies, and $7,500 in professional fees. That includes the court interpreters and additional use for contract. We found that our budget was low for use of contract court reporters. If I go, I'm assuming.
Judge, how do you regulate the contract reporters? You get the state pays for a reporter full-time, and how do you know, how do you regulate that?
When my reporter goes on vacation and I don't, and I have the need for a reporter, then I pay it out of my budget for a contract reporter. And I'm very fortunate, I might add, because I happen to have a reporter, a contract freelance reporter living in Rawlins. And so I've got somebody I can call on. I don't have to pay travel fees from Casper, Laramie, or Fort Collins. I know, Mr. Chairman, I'm moving fast, and if you have questions on any particular agency, I know that you won't hesitate to stop me and ask those questions. Page 23 is Judicial District 2B. That's Judge Donnell in Laramie. The only exception request is the court reporter. Page 30 takes us over to Judge Rickman in Green River, and you can see his exception requests. $2,000 for the National Judicial College training, $200 out-of-state travel, $400 office supplies, $5,800 for a printer, $4,500 for an interpreter. Page 35, Judicial District 3A, Judge Sanderson in Evanston, the court interpreter policy. Page 40, Judge Finn in Sheridan, and that is the $4,500 court interpreter. I have corresponded at some length with Judge Finn. If you have any questions regarding the request for a new judge in the 4th Judicial District, I'd be glad to entertain those questions. That takes us to page 48, Judicial District 5A, Judge Scar, Thermopolis and Moreland. You can see his request for the Bighorn water adjudication.
Going back to page 45, under Judge Scar, you will see again just the $4,500 for interpreter fees in his main administration budget.
Now on the water litigation, page 48 and 49, is that 100 that drops in and we replenish it, or is that an increase in the contract price?
Mr. Chairman, due to the code of 0903, that does drop out every year, and he does have to request this as long as this case is ongoing. This does pay for the services provided by the special master on this litigation. Pardon me? you would ask me. Ramsey, I can't think of her last name. Crooks? Ramsey Crooks? Crux? Mr. Chairman, I do believe she charges by the hour for this because we are in what we've thought is the home stretch for the last two bienniums. I do know that they are waiting on corrections to be made on some of the water rights coming out of the state engineer's office. So they, again, encourage to complete this lawsuit here soon.
With respect to the salaried employees, where are they stationed? Are they... You got two employees. Are they in here in Cheyenne, or are they?
No, Mr. Chairman. Those two employees are in Thermopolis.
They generally legal attorneys, or are these just staff people?
Mr. Chairman, these are just staff people.
It comes out of water too.
No, Mr. Chairman. It no longer comes out of the water. What do I want to call it? It is all general fund dollars now.
That Ramsey Crooks, you said, is that a person that lives in Wyoming or someplace else? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, it's my understanding this particular special master is out of Colorado. And I do believe she has been on this case for many, many years.
Yeah, and we just had a U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the doctrine of recapture, I believe, and they're still working on, is it the Wells right now, or do you know?
That, Mr. Chairman, I don't know.
Okay.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I think that takes us to page 53, Judicial District 5B, Judge Cranfill and Cody, and only the court interpreter request. Mr. Chairman, page 63, Judicial District 7A.
58.
Oops, excuse me. Page 58, Judicial District 6A, Judge Price and Gillette. Again, only the interpreter request. Page 63, Mr. Chairman, Judge Parks' request from Judicial District 7A in Casper. $3,000 communication request, and I'll let Ms. Odendahl talk about this in more detail. That is split between the 7th Judicial District and the three judges, I believe. The communication request, the in-state travel request, and again, the court interpreter request. Page 73, Mr. Chairman, is Judicial District 9A.
Judge Walter.
Chairman.
Can you tell me how difficult it is to find interpreters across the state? I'm sure it's different in, based on population. But
Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, it's very difficult, and it seems to depend greatly where you are. It is not difficult, for example, in Rawlins to find a Spanish-speaking interpreter. What is extremely difficult is to find a certified court interpreter. And I can tell you that it is, based on my experience, traumatic to take a person who is extremely fluent in Spanish and throw them into a courtroom setting with a whole new jargon in that traumatic setting in particular. And I've seen fluent Spanish speakers who were not able to perform under the courtroom setting. And so the certification process adds a whole new level, both to finding them and to the cost. And then that doesn't even address the Serbian truck driver going down I-80. Or the Croatian or Russian speaker, it can be very, very difficult.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, I don't know if you've had an opportunity to read the actual policy in the appendix, but the Supreme Court does plan to provide training to local interpreters who court judges use now to do courtroom environment, go over what's expected, what they should or should not do, have them take a test to make sure they are understanding the legal terminology being used in a courtroom environment. And once they have taken that test, we will put them on a roster that can be used statewide by all of the circuit and district court judges. Once they have taken, again, and passed that test, that gives them the opportunity to earn more than $20 an hour for court interpreting fees to maybe earn maybe $40 an hour. It is very hard to get anyone to come, as Judge Waldrop indicated, to come into some of our courts across the state.
So to follow up then, possibly Cheyenne with a larger population would have more individuals with the language capability. So then if you had a case in Rollins, you would pay mileage to bring them over?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, that's exactly right. Not only would I pay mileage, but on a several-day trial, as most of our trials are, then I'm going to have to pay her cost of lodging as well. It doesn't seem to be directly related to the population base. For example, Laramie seems to have, and I assume because of the university, they have more interpreters or easier to find. Evanston, because of its proximity to the church in Salt Lake City, provides some good interpreters to us all as well. There's also a telephonic ATT interpreter service, again, through the church in Salt Lake City that there's questions about their certification, but they can provide many, many languages over the telephone on a 24/7 basis, and it's very, very expensive. The problem that we have is I have had Cambodian defendants and Laotian defendants and the Croatian, and those are just real hard to find.
Do you have many frequencies on hearing impaired individuals?
Not a lot. Usually where we see hearing impaired is jury selection, oddly enough, when we bring those citizens in on a veneer panel, and we have some devices that we make available in our courtroom. You've seen them advertised on TV. You put the little gizmo in your pocket and the earbuds in your ears, and those seem to take care of most of our issues.
We need to go back.
Directing your attention to page 68, Judicial District 7B, Judge Sullins. Again, that's the other half of Judge Park's $3,000 communication request, $2,000 travel, and court interpreter. Page 73, Judge Young's court interpreters. Mr. Chairman, if you'll go to page 79, that is Judge Couts in Torrington, and you can see that the only exception he requests is the court interpreter policy. Page 84, 9B, Judge Day in Jackson. Again, the only exception request is the court interpreter. Chairman, if you'll go to page 89, Gillette, Judicial District 6B, Judge Perry, and you will see only the exception of the court interpreter policy. Directing, Mr. Chairman, your attention to page 94, that's Judge Brooks' request. And as I've told you, that Judge Brooks is the only district judge who does not currently have his own law clerk. You will see the court interpreter request, but in addition to that, you see the request for the cost of a law clerk to live in Douglas to work for Judge Brooks. Again, we believe that will provide a much better service to our client base, and I'm shocked that he hasn't made this request years ago. Judge Brooks is here, Mr. Chairman, if you have any questions for him. Then, Mr. Chairman, if you will turn to page 100. That is Cheyenne's Judicial District 1C, Judge Arnold. The only request is for an interpreter or the funds to pay a court interpreter under the new policy. Page 105, Judicial District 3C, Judge James in Green River. Her only exception request is for a court interpreter. Mr. Chairman, if you'll turn to page 110, that is Judicial District 7C, Judge Wilking. And she has only the court interpreter request. Mr. Chairman, if you'll go to page 115, we finish up in Gillette. That is with Judge Deegan, Judicial District 6C. Nope, I have missed something. Judge Odendahl. Judge Odendahl. Joanne Odendahl is going to straighten me up. Ah, how could I miss that? Please go to page 120, Mr. Chairman. That is Judge Tyler's request out of Judicial District 9C, Pinedale, for an automobile. And I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have concerning Judge Tyler's request.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I $12,000 for the is that typically what we spend for a yearly in a state vehicle?
No, Mr. Chairman. As you see, the difference in the coding, the $12,000 is for the monthly maintenance fee, and that comes from code 0223. The $5,000 office supplies, the $27,000 is for the permanently assigned vehicle in 0243. That is a one-time request to purchase the vehicle, and then the monthly maintenance fee kicks in, which would be a standard budget item. That amount, plus what he currently has in in-state travel, will cover the cost of that car. That maintenance fee that is paid then goes into somewhat what we call like a sinking fund. In 7 to 8 years, that car will be replaced then by motor pool. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, did you just ask? I think you asked. Did you just ask? So the $488 a month goes to ANI. Is that who you pay that to?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Senator Representative Edmonds.
Question back on the law clerk. Is that salary coming in at the 91%? Or I'm just curious whether we started that person at 91%.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, it is based on a salary of $54,000, which is currently less than the Attorney General's office begins law clerks at. It's consistent with what we are now paying law clerks right out of law school. But a district judge typically will, and correct me if I'm wrong, will decide what that particular law clerk will start at depending on the location. And sometimes they bring them in at maybe $48,000, $50,000 and see how they do, and in 6 months provide them a pay increase. So that gives the judge the flexibility to bring them in a little bit less if they so desire.
The difference there, could that be used to put in another fund to fund sick leave when someone retired? Or what happens to that difference?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, if I'm understanding, if those funds are not used for the salary, they do revert back to the general fund. We struggle in the judicial branch. Whatever our salaries are on a particular date is what goes into our standard budget for the next biennium. Several executive branches, agencies have enough employees to where if there's a vacancy, they can provide pay raises to their individual employees if they so see fit. We have 4 employees in most of our offices, and as you see here, maybe 3 employees. So if there's a vacancy and there's a an impact to that budget, we cannot bring anyone in. Maybe if they have better experience or something, we still cannot bring that employee in at a higher salary. We are tied to that salary until legislature appropriates funds for pay raises.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. So you can't pool all of the different district court judges as far as on an annual basis and keep that money. So if you have a retirement, use your 100 series monies to pay for the sick leave that's accumulated?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, in this current biennium that we are in right now, under the Board of Judicial Policy and Administration budget in Supreme Court, we have asked and you appropriated $150,000 to be made available to the entire judicial branch for those particular buyouts of long-time employees. And we have used quite a bit of those funds. If we were to pay everyone who's eligible to retire right now, it would be over $600,000 or $700,000 for those buyouts. And so this was a mechanism to help us defer those costs out of the individual district court budget. So we do have that fund available.
That fund, but there's no way to replenish it.
No way to pool all of the district courts. No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, part of the model historically was your law clerks would come in served 2 or 3 years and then head out, and we're now seeing more professional clerks. So, and this may go back tying to the other discussion, and that is, how do you get, if you get a clerk and you're going to give him 5, 6 years, how do you continue to provide pay increases except through this process? And I guess at that point, and then flip side of that, if we allow that process, say, okay, now you can go up to pay grade 7, 8, 9 years, then if you rehire, how do you readjust or self-adjust back to the lower salary? And we do it with teachers all the time, but in the judiciary, I mean, I'm not sure how you're doing it. I just know that obviously there is a disparity of what is paid, and it may not be reflected by your line item for your law clerk, or is it?
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. If I'm understanding, if you're indicating that, okay, maybe an attorney, a law clerk who has stayed on 7 or 8 years, then decides to leave employment.
About just how do you get pay increases to the law clerk other than the cost of living? And
we don't, Mr. Chairman. I mean, whatever legislature appropriates to the judicial branch is the only pay raises we are able to give.
But do you have law clerks that are being paid $70,000, $80,000, or are there none that are getting those salaries?
We probably, well, are you the Supreme Court included? We do have a few law clerks, yes, over $70,000, yes.
How about in the district courts?
I think we have one who has been there and was able to receive those 4% pay raises when we were...
Been there long enough that...
Yes.
So then when that clerk leaves, does the budget drop down to the replacement value, or does that judge just command a larger budget on account of that?
Well, if a judge, that particular judge, Mr. Chairman, would bring a law clerk in that has years of experience and is able to defend that salary, then he has that opportunity to do so. If he brings someone in right out of law school, then that salary goes down. That's what would be budgeted then, the lower salary for the next biennium.
And it gets back to the other discussion that we've had in the years past, and that is, should we be providing a vehicle for judges to look to a common source of money to hire more experienced law clerks and pay them more? And we've never really had a good answer to that. I mean, there's the Bar Association kind of likes you mentoring our lawyers and sending them out after 3 or 4 years, and judges would like to keep them longer. So it's just there's always an issue there. I don't know how you answer it. Does this then tie back to why you're looking for merit pay? Because you're looking for some judge, some law clerks that have really been there longer, and you're trying to reward them for staying?
Mr. Chairman, yes. It's a variety of law clerks or clerks, so to speak, in the circuit courts. I mean, I didn't bring with me the actual list of how we came up with the $173,000 for merit raises, but it's a variety of employees. And not that many employees. I mean, we don't have a lot of employees receiving pay raises. I mean, not everyone is going to get a pay raise. With that, Mr. Chairman, we are finished.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, before I leave, you can see now, as you said, through the Supreme Court and the District Court, what Joanne Odendahl does for us all. And I want, before this committee, I want to pay homage to who does all of the rest of us are figureheads. And Ms. Odendahl does all of the work for all of us, and we appreciate her very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we thank this committee for your time as well.
You got to do this.